All right, Dr. Mittman, we have quorum, and everyone that is scheduled to be here, I believe, is online. So,
okay, great. Three, two, one. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
The January 28th, 2021 meeting of the Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education is called to order at 10 a.m. on the button. The board may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any matter on the agenda. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items with the exception of hearings. The audio recording of the December 10th, 2020 meeting has been posted on the website. As a reminder, the state board's policy for the recording of minutes is to audio record all meetings and post to the website. Mr. LaMountain, can you confirm that the audio minutes of the December 10th, 2020 meeting have been posted and are audible?
Mr. Chair, I can confirm that the board meeting minutes for December 10th, 2020 are available online and are audible.
Okay. And I forgot, do we need a motion to accept these or do we just proceed?
We do need a motion to accept.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Rachel, could you call the roll so we know who all is here, and then we'll get a motion.
Perfect. So I will start with the board members. Board Chair, Dr. Paul Mittman.
Present.
Mr. Mike Romano.
Present.
Dr. Jennifer Leck.
Here.
Dick Lukey.
Here.
And Mr. Scott Wallace?
Here.
Mr. Kevin LaMountain?
Present.
Mr. Keith Blanchard?
Here.
Ms. Terry Stanfill?
Here.
Myself, Rachel Kias, I am present. And Assistant Attorney General, Seamus Monahan?
I am here, thank you, Rachel.
Very welcome. And I believe that concludes that. Have I missed anyone?
No, just as a reminder, Mr. Tharp will not be part of the meeting today as he's ill.
Okay, so before we get a motion, Mr. LaMountain, do I just pick another board member to take lead on Mr. Tharp's assignment? Or
we can either pick or you can ask for volunteers.
I'm just kidding, since this is why I get paid extra to be the board chair. Right. So I get I do get paid extra, don't I?
No, you don't actually. but thanks for asking.
All right. Well, we're going to have to obviously improvise. Mr. Tharp had lead on Ocean Point. So can we get a motion to accept the board minutes for December 10th? 2020.
This is Scott Wallace. I make the motion to accept the board minutes for December 10th.
This is Michael Romano. I'll second that.
Great. Rachel, could you call the vote?
Dr. Paul Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Mike Romano?
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck?
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lubke?
Aye.
And Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
Ayes have it.
Okay.
This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. I'm sorry, Dr. Mittman. I just wanted to make sure before we move on to number three, I noticed there weren't any conflicts of interest noted on here. So if anybody has any conflicts with the schools that are coming before the board today, if you just want to announce that any of those conflicts now, that'd be appreciated.
Okay. So we have East Valley Medical College, Arizona Medical Training, Ocean Point Dental Academy, United States University, and Barry Best Phlebotomy. Are there any conflicts of interest? Conflicts of interest. Hearing none, why don't we move forward with the executive director's report, Mr. O'Malley?
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Seamus. Thank you, Dr. Mittman and board. In your board folder, I did provide some information regarding the executive director's report. I want to go through it briefly. I will have to say that today is probably one of our shortest agendas we've had in many, many years. So
don't jinx anything.
I'm not going to. I'm done. That's it. That's as far as I'm going. So just
so
a brief
overview. The executive director's report is over. Let's move on.
All right. Let's move on. So I've included in the folder in the executive director report financials for where we were at as of the end of December. We are tracking basically where we thought we would be for both revenues and expenses. Expenses are down a little bit in part due to the change in Terry's role and my role and how that's worked out. And then additionally, we're still waiting for a give back from the department, the DOA, our rent went down about $8,000. So we're waiting for that to hit into the expense side. I haven't seen that come in. I don't think that's going to actually happen until April, based on a conversation that I had with Nola Barnes, who is the individual working directly with that. December, as a reminder, is somewhat of a, obviously it's a short month. We don't collect a lot of revenue in December. But there's no renewals that are due. Right now we are setting on the largest group of schools that are going through the renewal cycle that have 71 currently that are due on or before February 1st. So our next revenue cycle that you'll see coming in will show the revenue that's going to come in from those 70 plus institutions. So you'll see a big bump in revenue when we get into our next reporting period. We're going to have two sections on Strife today. One, I'm just going to give you a really brief update. I did provide information in your folder about where we are at currently with collecting monies from the Student Tuition Recovery Fund, both those that were billed in July with a due date of October and those that were billed in the end of July with a due date of March 1st. And I'm working with those institutions. There's some institutions that we're still trying to come up with a definitive number. And this is primarily in the regionally accredited institutions are coming up specifically with that, what that number looks like in order for the invoice to be accurate. So that information is in there. So in terms of Strife, we're going to have another discussion here in a minute that I'll show you or give you some indication of where we have, where we are, where we have been, where we're going with potential changes in Strife moving forward in 2021. Again, we've collected, we've got about $246,000 in the Strife account as of today. Again, that will probably increase and decrease over the next few months as we receive more information or more revenue from the institutions that were previously considered regional. Really, I moved on to the next section, which is the COVID impact. COVID is still a concern for a lot of the smaller schools, continuing to operate either in a hybrid mode or virtual. I do think that that's going to impact the modality of a number of schools as we finish out 2021 and go into 2022, that there's going to be some institutions that will just continue to stay in a virtual mode. And again, a lot of those smaller schools are still having some impact from this. Number four, new school closure. We talked about this last month, but Southwest University of Visual Arts closed and ceased operations on December 18th of 2020. I have 2021 in here. It's 2020. I visited the campus about 2 weeks ago, made sure that all the PII information was removed from the building. Been working with both the bankruptcy court and the new, they've converted from to a chapter 7. They converted a couple of weeks ago from an 11 to a 7. And going through that process of working with them, there were about 65 boxes of records that I reviewed, of which I gave them the authority to shred those documents so that we don't need them. I do have a tremendous number of digital files and digital files that at this point in time I can't read because of the systems that have been somewhat of a challenge to figure out how to open up some of those files. But I do have a very solid set of records that go back to about 2002. It's the ones prior to 2002 that I'm going to have some challenges with. We are in receipt so far of, and Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we have received one strife. Did we receive any additional strife for SUVA at this time?
Yeah, we have two now, and both are around 8,000.
All right. So so we're looking at a, you know, roughly $16,000 plus impact to strife at this point in time. For this particular institution, we do believe that there will be more. Again, as a reminder, we have until December 18th of 2021 for anybody to claim against the student tuition recovery fund. So we still have quite a bit of time left. We've had two sessions with those students, two town halls with those students to give them information about what we're doing, how they can get their transcripts. On our website, I've provided quite a bit of information about process, what they can do for the Department of Education, what they can do for us, and then any new information that I receive to help those particular students out. Beyond that, as the dashboard shows you that we're currently at 218 schools. We were 212 last year. We have four that are in the pending. Two of those, or three of those new schools, will come on today. Yeah, we have three new institutions that will be on today. And there have been a couple of additional schools that I won't mention at this time that have elected not to renew their license, but they still have until February 1st to make that decision. So when we come into our next board meeting in February, I'll let you know where we are with that. We have three service requests in. Two of those will be heard for a change of ownership will be heard today. And then new locations four and new programs of 23. The renewal applications, you'll see that we've completed the ones that expired on December 31st. There were roughly 40 of those institutions. I'm still waiting on two folks that still owe us some documentation before I could submit and approve their license at a staff level. Quite a few transcript requests that have come in. Rachel's been very busy with getting those out to the various students and to the various schools that were that are asking for them. No additional schools on teach out. You can see I put in the additional ed monitoring for HCM1. Thankfully, we don't have anybody on HCM2 at this time. But those are the institutions that are on HCM1. I know I did put in my report the accreditation action, which is the U.S. Department of Education, potential derecognition again of ACICS. We only have one institution in the state of Arizona that's ACICS accredited. They have given me a full plan on what they're going to do and what they have been doing. So I'm not of a concern with that particular institution that they, I think they'll be able to make their deadlines for going to a different accreditor. Legislative update, I wanted to just briefly go over that. SB 1151, and I know Fred just joined from APSA. I would like to give him a shout out to thank him and APSA for moving forward SB 1151. I'd also like to thank Senator Shope for agreeing to sponsor that. SB 1151 is the replacement bill for last year's SB 1279, which was going to strike our chapter from that requirement or the exemption of those institutions that were above, $6,000 or $8,000 and less than $150,000 per total transaction, assuming everything was online. So that has passed the Senate, both the Rules Committee just happened, and the Commerce Committee. It had passed both of those. So it'll go on to a full House or to a full Senate vote, and then moving forward, it'll go on to a go over to the House. It is unclear at this point in time how long the legislature is going to be in session. It's, you know, in years past, it's last year it ended abruptly. The year before that, it went on about 3 weeks or 4 weeks longer than it was supposed to go. We've heard rumblings that it could close as early as next week, or go through April or May. So we'll just have to let you know what's going on there with that. I have met with quite a few people over the last few weeks, both in the legislature and in both the governor's office and the Senate Education Committee, with individuals that are going to be helpful in the next part that we're going to talk about here in a moment. We did receive our notification of our sunset for our board. I have Dr. Mittman has received the information as well. We will start working on that throughout this year, heavily working on it in 2022, and in 2023 is the year of that we will be moving forward with, getting a lot of support and a lot of people coming out and helping us through that as we get that through the legislature in 23. That is my executive director's report. Are there any questions?
Kevin, this is Dick Lubke. You know, as we kind of sit back and observe all the executive orders that are being reversed in Washington and different sorts of initiatives from the previous administration, has your staff, do you anticipate that the Department of Ed would reverse course and reinstate the regional recognition of schools?
Mr. Chair or Mr. Lukey, good question. So the answer is, it is unknown at this point in time. First of all, we don't know who the secretary has not been has not been confirmed at this point in time. We don't know who the undersecretary that's going to be really responsible for the higher ed policies. We don't know who that individual is going to be at this time. That will be a little more clear over the next month. What I did is I talked to one of the lobbyists for a group that heavily lobbies for private education in Washington, D.C. His take on it was that if they were going to do something with that to reverse it, it's going to have to go through the entire rulemaking process, which it can't be an executive order. The president in this case couldn't go in and just strip that component out. It has to go through the process, which in my understanding and what his understanding is the earliest it would be is about 2 years. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions on that?
I have a few other questions. On SB 1151, that this is in response to Governor Ducey's, I think it was an executive order from a year or so ago, that kind of threw us into the same pot with respect to organizations under a certain size that have a contract that wouldn't need licensure, right? So
right.
Since he signed it, do we have any, do we know, you know, how the governor stands on this? Would he sign this bill if it gets passed by the legislature?
So, Mr. Chair, yes. He did sign the bill, but he signed it in again, thanks to the APSA and a number of others that sent in quite a few letters to the governor's office stating that they're concerned over this. So the governor issued, at the time he signed that into law, which was 2 years ago, the governor issued a letter that basically stated that the parties need to get together and work this out and come up with an agreement, which typically doesn't happen. So I think that means that there was support moving forward for for this. The governor's office is very aware of it. The Senate is very aware of it. And I don't think it would have been signed last year had this made it through prior to COVID.
Okay. Well, great. Good. And then going back to the Strike Fund and SUBA, mm-hmm. How many students attended the two sessions that you had? And I'm asking that kind of kind of just broadly to get a sense of do you have a crystal ball as to how many people are going to apply for Strike funds? Because I know the total amount is potentially close to $850,000, which far exceeds what's in the Strike Fund. I'm just wondering, are we like crossing our fingers and hoping that we have two now and we'll have like 6 or 10, or are we gonna see a deluge?
Mr. Chair, I cross my fingers every day that we have very few strife claims moving forward. We had about 35 students on the first meeting that we did. We also had participants from the United States Department of Education, Veterans Affairs. So that was a good meeting. The second meeting we had, which was just before the Christmas break, we had, I believe it was 4 or 5 individuals on the phone. It wasn't a tremendous number. And from that point, we've had two. So my crystal ball would tell me, I think a number of these students, there were articulation agreements with two other institutions, one in San Francisco, which is the University of Art, and another institution that was in Colorado that I know some individuals were very interested in moving over into to complete their degree. And then there's also a few students that went to the University of Arizona. So I still think that there's a big, I will just tell you kind of like the swing of when things happen. We're getting closer to tax time. And when we get closer to tax time, that's when people realize that they may or may not have their 1098-T form sent to them by the institution, and then when they start doing that realization of how much money they owe, that's when they start asking a lot more questions. So I would assume by April, we'll have a better idea. Great. Any other questions? And then we can move on. So I agendized this last week when we put everything together of a review, discussion, and possible action regarding proposed changes in statutes related to the strife assessment. That has somewhat changed, and I really just want to give you an understanding of where we're at with the strife. I know I placed in your board folder a proposed change in the statute of the 32, chapter 32. So that is in here. But let me kind of give you an update as to where we are and some possible actions moving forward. I've had a number of meetings with a small group of institutions, a focus group for the Student Tuition Recovery Fund. And in that group, I have two institutions that represent non-accredited vocational schools. I have two that were previously recognized as a national institutions. And I have three members that are part of what was previously regional institutions. We've met a number of times about having conversations about what potential solutions that this group could come up with. Initially, we were hoping to have something to put in front of the committee today to talk about a consensus that we may or may not have come up with, or that we may have come up with, that we could move legislation forward. At this time, that hasn't happened. We do not have consensus. We are still working through some language, working through some how things may be recognized. I've put together a number of scenarios. I would like to thank all the members of that committee for really embracing this, helping us move this forward. I believe it's been very productive. We've had very good solid outcomes of various meetings that we've had. But unfortunately, as of today, where we sat, we are not there. We are not there where we can move legislation forward. So for the timeline, just so that everyone understands, we really needed to have a bill in a folder and a sponsor by Monday of this week. As that didn't happen, we have no legislation can be introduced, no new legislation can be introduced after Monday, February 1st. So we will not make, obviously, we're not going to make either one of those deadlines. I've had conversations with the governor's office, conversations with the Senate Education Committee about potential next steps. And we're really at a point where we've got to have some more meetings. It was made clear to me by the Senate, by Brooke White, who is the in the Senate Education Committee. She is she's been very, very unbelievably helpful with this. Met with her last week, and we're looking at other options that we may be able to come up with to help this process along with changing any potential legislation with strife. I just don't know if we're going to make it in this particular year. The only way that we could do it is if we had a consensus. We sent it out to all of our schools and we had a consensus there. And then we moved forward with potentially doing a strike all amendment on another bill, assuming we could get a senator to buy into that. And at this point in time, that we're quite a ways away. So I wish I had more information and more news on that. But I would be open to any questions that the board has. So hearing none, there is another option that I am looking at, and I've had conversations again with the governor's office and Senate about potentially doing a one-time appropriation this year for strife that may help us build that money back up into our strife fund. We had a budget meeting, a statewide budget meeting yesterday, actually. There is some money in the budget that we may be able to at least ask for. I would need a directive to do that from the board. We're not there yet, so I anticipate doing that if we need to do a special meeting sometime in early February to get the direction to do that, or wait until our February meeting. I just have to find out what the timing is on asking for that appropriation. And that is what I have.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Mr. LaMountain, for the for all the extra work. This was unanticipated, or maybe it was anticipated, but it sort of landed like a thud a few months back. And is it appropriate for the board to either come from the board or to come from your office to send a letter of acknowledgement to the group that you've been working with? I know that they represent different constituencies within the within our schools.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And if you wanted to pen something like that from the board to this group, that would be wonderful, and I'd love to send that out to them.
Okay. As board chair, can I just assign somebody on the board?
You know, remember, you get paid more. Oh, wait. We've already talked about that. So.
All right, well, I'll send, Ms. O'Man, if you could send me an email that lists the individuals in the schools, I'll
sure.
be happy to send Great. Them. I'll send them a letter and copy you.
Great. Okay. So if we'll move on, and Dr. Mittman, I don't have this, I didn't do a board report for this because it should be relatively quick. So if you're good, I'll just announce this and introduce it and then see if we can take action on it.
Yep.
Great. So before the board today is review and discussion of possible action regarding the reduction of a surety bond for I.M. Hart. IM Heart has been licensed by this board for quite some time. In your board folder, there was a letter stating the reason for the reduction of the bond, and it's really due to the fact that there are no students in the institution at this particular point in time for this program. They do have other programs that they offer, but they're not licensed by our board. So this is one particular program that is licensed by the board. They're seeking the reduction from a $40,000 per year to a $15,000 to meet the minimum requirement. In front of the board today, speaking on behalf of IM Heart, is Ms. Dee O'Neill. Dee, do you want to give a just a real quick overview or just opening statement?
Well, essentially, this is a program that we do not run every year, because most of the students who join the Hercalia Healing Program go through our other meditation two-year program before they would join the Hercalia Healing. And we need a certain number of students available so that we can even run a class. So we've only run one class, and that was that ended probably two or three years ago. It's an 18-month program. And we probably will not run it again until maybe starting in January, but that's a huge, huge maybe. If and when we start running it again, we will notify the board and let you know, or notify the staff, and they'll let you know that. And at that point, we'll let you know how many students we have, and then a decision could be made as to whether to raise it or not. We don't have any income, is why we've had to relicense every year for $600, and we haven't had income to pay for that, and we haven't had income to pay for the bond, and we keep paying for that every year. So all of a sudden I thought, well, geez, why don't we just do minimum, hopefully, at this point.
Sure. Well, that sounds reasonable. could I ask, where are you located?
Well, we actually are international, but our main office is in Tucson.
Oh, okay, good. Well, great. Well, it's nice to meet you. And you know, just from reading the letter that was in the board packet, you know, I feel supportive of it. So, can we get a motion to reduce the bond? We'll get a motion, a second, and then if there's any discussion, we'll have that afterwards.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, I motion to reduce the bond to the $15,000.
Okay. This is Scott Wallace. I second the motion.
Okay. All right. Is there any discussion?
I have one question, yeah. Dr. Mittman. Is it possible, after you take a vote and hopefully approve this, that I could get a letter? My bond renewal is early February. I think I have until like the 10th or 12th to pay the bond, or they'll cancel us. So I need something from you all, hopefully from Kevin, that would allow me to give it to the bonding agent.
Well, thankfully, as the auditor will find out, we'll find out when she and her staff do the sunset review process. Our crack team staff will, I'm sure, get you your necessary documentation ASAP.
Thank you.
So unless you have any other requests, Rachel, why don't you call the vote?
Okay. Mr. Mike Romano?
Yes.
May I have your vote, aye or nay?
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Jennifer Leck?
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lupke?
Aye.
Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Mittman?
Aye.
All right, ayes have it.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Good luck.
Thank you. And Dee, I will get you that letter. I'll get that out this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for all your help on this.
You bet. Anytime. Thank you.
The board should know how helpful your staff is always. I've never had anything but good working relationship with Terry and Kevin and who's the other one? Keith. So, and I'm sure there are others, but.
Thank you.
Well, we wish you lots of success and serenity in these turbulent times. Okay. All right. Moving on, we've got some licensing to do. And so for we have two schools with change of ownerships. The first is East Valley Medical College. Our lead is Mr. Wallace, but before we turn over to Mr. Wallace, Mr. LaMountain, can you give us a brief summary or introduction?
Sure. Dr. Mittman and members of the board, East Valley Medical College has been licensed by our board since 2014. They are currently accredited by ACCET, and they are in the process of requesting a change of ownership. The staff has read the materials and have agreed to that we are comfortable with moving this forward to the board. So the individuals today I have up on the screen, I'm not exactly sure which one, whether it's Tom or Joanna, who is going to be the initial person that is going to have a conversation. But your board lead is Mr. Wallace.
Yeah, this is Scott Wallace. Do you have any comments that you'd like to make prior to me asking some questions about this transition?
Are you asking the school, Mr. Wallace?
Yes.
Joanna is here, and I believe Barry is here too on the call. And this is Tom Cuby. We're happy to present ourselves to the board. East Valley is a good little school. The entity that's acquiring it has been in the Allied quite some time, and we're excited to be moving into Arizona with another campus.
So can you tell me a little bit about where the organization is headquartered?
This is Joanna Russell. I'm the president of Sumner College. Good morning, everyone. I'm up here in Portland, Oregon. So Sumner College has one campus in the Portland area. It's a physical campus. We have been around since 1974. I've been here in this role at the college for about 14 years at this point. My background includes a lot of work with compliance and accrediting bodies. We have nursing programs here at the Portland campus. We have a licensed practical nursing program, an associate degree in nursing, registered nursing associate degree program, and we also have an RN to BSN bachelor's in nursing program. Those are the main programs we have here in Oregon. We do have a medical assisting program we started about 2.5 years ago, and that program is doing very well. They are all accredited by ABHES. That's our institutional accrediting body. We are approved by the Department of Education for Title IV funding, and then we're approved by the state of Oregon by HEC, and then by the nursing boards in Washington State and Oregon both. Washington because of clinical experiences, even though our physical campus is only in the Portland area.
Okay. Now, Tom, are you the person in charge of the Arizona campus?
Yes, right now I serve as the interim campus administrator during the transition and the change from the previous ownership to the new ownership.
Were you employed by the previous ownership?
Was I employed? No, I was not.
Okay. In terms of faculty and staff, what kind of changes are going to be made or have been made at this point?
Currently, we don't anticipate any changes on staff. Everyone has remained. Jennifer Brumback, who was one of the previous owners, is staying on as a program development director to help us with current programs and looking forward to other program offerings in the allied health field.
I looked at your forecast for the next 2 years, I think it is. It's a pretty modest forecast, at least in terms of enrollment and revenues. Is there any anticipation that that's Is that considered a conservative forecast, or do you anticipate expanding?
We looked at keeping it conservative, and Barry can possibly speak to this too, only because the COVID situation lends a degree of uncertainty to the marketplace for career training. So we're trying to look at it as conservatively as possible.
Okay. In terms of your catalog, have you made, can you highlight or give to the board any major changes in your catalog before and after the merger?
The only changes that we made to the catalog would reflect the change of ownership to Cascade and Sumner College, and reflecting the new ownership, the board of on Cascade Ed, and the new administration of the school. Everything else remains the same.
Can you comment on how COVID or this pandemic has affected operations, either up north in Portland, or what you anticipate to happen here in Arizona?
Joanna, do you want to talk about that first?
Sure. In the Portland, up at the Portland campus, we've actually seen growth the past 10 months under COVID. As we have a nursing program, it's in very high demand currently in the Northwest. I don't know about Arizona, but there's a nursing shortage in the Northwest. So we were able to quickly adapt in about a 10-day period from 100% on campus to a hybrid model where labs and clinical were still taught on campus and smaller groups are out in the field, but everything else was moved over to a Canvas platform. So we've seen a growth in the Portland area. At the Arizona school, there has been a decrease in the student population because of clinical availability. So we've worked with the clinical sites with whatever they can accommodate for students, and we've adjusted the numbers accordingly to those, you know, to the availability down in the Arizona area.
Okay. That is all the questions I have. Do my fellow board members have any other questions?
This is Dr. Leck. I actually have quite a few, which all surround the enrollment agreement and some of the catalog. So if you go into the enrollment agreement, it says on there, like in the cost box, it says books are on loan and uniforms on loan. And just as I was going through all the documentation, I didn't see anything that happened, like what would happen if that stuff didn't get returned. Maybe I missed it. But what would happen if they didn't? You would just withhold their transcripts or something? Or they'd have to pay for it?
That's actually a change we have to make from the catalog that you see there, because we've gone to a inclusive tuition where the books are included now, so that the students, they keep the books.
Oh, so that'd be good.
Do alone.
Same okay. Okay. Well, I'm assuming you're going to probably want to look at a lot of the changes that I'm suggesting, but like when you look on page 2 of 5, there's a little blurb there that has, it's trying to give an example of how payments would work. But the interesting thing about that is that the example is saying that the medical assistant program was 60, if the tuition is 6,100, but up in the box, the cost is actually 4,800 on the enrollment agreement. And yet in the catalog, I'm almost positive it was like 8,000. So nothing is consistent.
I'm pulling that up now.
Okay.
We missed that because we submitted this back earlier. What page are you on the?
The enrollment agreement, it's right on this first box that says cost. And this says the medical assistant, so I'm just looking at that.
Yes, this. The current tuition is $8,700, and with the registration fee is $200. And I apologize. I thought we fixed that and sent that in. with the corrected number.
Okay, and then if you look on the next page, you're giving an example of how payments would work, and it's about the medical assistant program, so I would use the same tuition, and this one says 6,100. So just maybe going through and looking at consistency.
Yep, yep.
On this page as well, on the second page, the refund and cancellation policy to me is super confusing because at the bottom it says that the gist of this is that you have two refund policies that you're looking at. One is from the state and one is from ACCET, right? Yeah. But in here you say the state is always more generous. So then why even include the ACCET? You're always going to use the state and simplify this.
Well, that's correct, but asset, our accrediting agency, requires us to have both on the enrollment agreement, and we calculate both refunds if a student requires a refund, and they do get the one that's most generous to the student.
Wow, that's really confusing. Okay.
And also, if this is Joanna, if I can add to that, we are required as well up here with ABHES to have both. It is a requirement for Title IV as well. So with Department of Ed fundings, as we move forward down the road and get Title IV funding for the medical assisting, there will be an additional calculation that will have to be printed in the catalog for the Department of Ed as well. And it is always the one that's more favorable to the student, but we're required by institutional accrediting bodies in the department to have those in there as well.
I've never heard of that.
Hey, Dr. Leck, this is Keith Blatcher. Can I say something real quick, and Terry can chime in? So accredited institutions, the state board allows them to follow their accreditors' policy, so they don't have to have both. But what is required is the 72-hour cancellation notice. Those are required, but the actual refund policy can be just what your accreditor requires or the Department of Ed requires.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably why I've never seen it before, because this one, it just says, hey, we have two different ones. We're going to give you the other one. And there was just a lot of refund policies throughout. It was like, oh, my Lord, I haven't seen it before. So, okay. Let's see. In the cost on the enrollment agreement, I think you had some, you have the registration fee. But you don't show that's non-refundable. Like, it's in the calculations when you're putting, the refund stuff, but I didn't know if maybe on the top in the registration fee you wanted to put that was non-refundable. That was just a suggestion as I was reading through your documents.
Okay, we can certainly do that.
On the enrollment agreement too, it says program enrolled and it's a medical assistant. If you go to the right, it says credit/hours, but you guys don't deal with credits, do you? So then I was wondering why would credit be on there? Wouldn't you just take that off because you're only dealing with hours?
Sure, we can do that too.
Okay, I think that'll just help. After the commencement of classes, when it goes into the refund, it says, less the registration fee shall be determined as follows, but it also appears that you have a $100 withdrawal fee. So wouldn't that need to be reflected that it's minus 200 and minus 100 all in the same calc? Where is that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it looks confusing. It's the issue is that asset only allows us to keep $100 fee, not $200. So yes, the registration fee is $200, but in the event of a refund, the asset policy only allows us to keep $100 of that.
Okay, so it's down here. It's under tuition charges less refund. So then this says after the commencement of classes, the tuition refund less the registration fee, which was the $200, shall be determined as follows, but the $100 is above refund after the commencement of classes. So they're both after the commencement of classes, but they're not consistent.
Yeah, well, we can certainly look to see how we can make that less confusing.
Okay. You have a verification of high school. And the interesting thing about that is that it says you will check to make sure that they've graduated from an Arizona school. Or homeschool and then international. But I thought that was interesting because you could have someone move to here, not graduate from Arizona. So wouldn't it just be you, you're going to verify high school graduation period, not just in Arizona?
Yes, that's true. But they pretty much all of our students come from Arizona. We can make that edit.
Okay, so your student with disabilities policy, it doesn't actually mention who they should contact for accommodations. And your language, on my background, you might want to look at the language and look at case-by-case basis using those words because there's a lot of requirements in there. And then Title IX as well. You don't have a Title IX coordinator listed, and those are requirements of that. Under campus crime report, it says there is one, but it doesn't say how to get it. So I think that was a lot of it was how do people get these things that you offer to them?
Okay. So you're suggesting that we clarify the availability and where those things or activities can be obtained or discussed.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm going to go to your SAP policy, and that is in your catalog. And this one was, I think you want to go back and look and try and streamline it because it was very confusing. So we know that there's a couple different parts, right, where there's the quantitative and the qualitative, but your policy kind of jumps around. So then it'll be academic progress policy for clock hour courses, which is dealing with both the quant and the qual. Then it's about the review, and then it says set policy review, and then it's appeals. It's very repetitive. I think you could probably streamline it so that people could follow because you're mentioning the same things over in different places. Does that make sense?
It does, and we can take a look at that.
Okay. You have a statement in here that the Director of Education will assess all appeals, but what happens if that person is not there? So usually we just recommend that you add or designate to help you in cases, perhaps like now.
Say that again, please. I'm not sure I follow that.
The Director of Education will assess all appeals. It's in your appeals policy.
Yep.
And it's probably a good idea to add or designate because if that person doesn't happen to be there and you need to make an appeal decision, that
yep.
can always come back as a complaint. Yeah.
Okay. Actually, we have changed that. I'll have to look at that. But yes. Thank you.
Uh-huh. There is a policy in here about consecutive absences. So it says you can arrange an absence of 3 days with prior approval, but then I was curious, how do they make that up? Because your program is built on specific going through the hours, right? And you can't just pluck out those 3 days and put them at the end, or do they have to like stay out until they pick up with the next group? How does that work?
Well, I guess the way it's structured, it would depend on when the student was requesting that time off. They'd work with the faculty and staff to have a plan to make up those hours. So it really depends on, that's why we talk about prior approval, because based on where the student might be in the progression of the curriculum, the faculty would have to give them a plan to make up those hours, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so but is your program full day? Do they go all day long?
It does go all day long. There are some breaks that could be used to make up time. And it depends on what the curriculum the student is asking to miss.
And if I can add to this, this is Joanna in Portland. I'm sorry, I've been hearing a bit here and there. What we're moving to with ABHES, and we have our application almost ready to present to ABHES, the accrediting body who we're with. We have a 20% attendance policy up here. If you have an absence that's arranged prior to, you can make up the lab portion for a skills checkoff, but it does not make up the time. for that 20%. Once a student misses 20% of classes, they are dropped from the course, the class, and they have to retake it the following term or whenever it's offered again. So a number of these policies, as we move into Title IV funding and APES, will be adjusted. We did purchase the school just a few months ago, and so we're working through that with our HR department right now and looking over the different policies. So I just wanted to add that in as some of these questions have come up regarding enrollment agreements and such, that we do want to make it consistent with both campuses moving forward.
Got it. Okay, that's good. I thought this was interesting, and I just didn't know if it would come off. It just kind of struck me. There's a policy here about communication, and it says students are required to speak English, and English is bold and underlined. It just struck me as kind of funny, and, you know, potentially maybe offensive to others. I don't know. It struck me funny. Graduation requirements. You guys use the words accumulative, but the word is cumulative, so I think that's just going through and cleaning some of this up now that you said that and trying to streamline some of these, because, like, even your policy around passing a background check is just it's all over the place. They're just, they're kind of confusing. So if you're going to do that, then I think that would solve a lot of it.
Okay. Did you have any other comments or suggestions?
No, I think if you guys are cleaning it out, then I think you're going to see what I'm talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, if we could take a step back, I know Mr. Wallace had asked about this before, but I was trying to get perspective how you ended the year for FY20 in regard to student count. It looked like you were pretty significantly down, understandable with everything that's going on, but bouncing back to pretty close to what it was the previous year. Any perspective on how you ended 2020?
I actually have the day we ended this year with we had 111 students, which was down. Currently we have 15 students class today, with another 7 starting on Monday. So we're trending back up. The school did move to a brief stint with online instruction back when COVID originally hit. We are now doing only in-person instruction at East Valley, and we're practicing social distancing, so we're not taking full cohorts the way we could prior to COVID. So.
Thank you for that. It looks like, based on the financials that you're projecting, your expenses are going to go down and improving your margin. And I guess with no imminent changes planned for structure and what that looks like, how do you anticipate achieving that with the student population going down, but yet your overall revenue or net income going up?
Well, I'll answer that, and Joanna can add to it. We're doing more with lead generation now. We're getting more interest in the programs, particularly in the CNA and the phlebotomy courses, as well as the MA. But the phlebotomy and the CNA are getting pretty robust level of interest, and we are having students that have gone through the CNA and phlebotomy previously coming back to us to talk about enrolling in the MA program. So we're optimistic, and we're working hard to make sure that the lead flow and the getting students into interview and then convert them to starts is a priority. I'm sure that's true with most schools right now.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. It's just, if I'm understanding the way you've kind of projected your financials, you're planning on ramping up or getting back in enrollments, but your expenses look like they're going to be coming down. And I guess I'm trying to appreciate why that is or how you're achieving that.
Well, we do have one staff position that's vacant currently that we've decided not to fill in the interim time. It's on the admission staff, which helps with the salary expense that we would not incur going forward for this period right now. And we're certainly watching other expenses and looking to get the enrollments up. We've gotten more interest in the programs, and we're doing our best to convert them to starts. Most of the interest we get from prospective students, they do not want to go to school online. They want an in-class experience. So we think that's helpful, as I know a lot of other schools that would compete with some of our programs are doing a lot online versus in person. So we think we have a little bit of an advantage there, and that's what we're proceeding with.
This is Joanna in Portland. If I could just add, we have secured some pricing with some of the book publishers. We've been able to have whatever discounts, because we're a larger school up here. We're around 500 students for nursing. We've been able to secure the pricing with 20 to 30% discounts for the supplies that the students use for the books that we're using, the resources. We currently use Canvas for our operating platform system, and then our CRM for our student database. We've been able to add these additional students in this campus into our current system with a lot of those things that we were paying individual pricing for down there. So we've went in to look at keeping the quality and the products the same and the supplies for the students, but being able to wrap them into a contract with our main campus up here for more competitive pricing.
Thank you for that. That's all my questions.
Hey, any other questions, Mr. Wallace? I have one question. This is Paul Mittman. A couple of things. First of all, your program in Portland, you mentioned nursing programs, and it looks like the four programs that you have comprise the vast majority of your students and revenue. Do you expect to replicate that here in Arizona, or do we stick with the East Valley Medical College model?
So our future plans as far as the next few years, we would like to start a nursing program in Arizona. Our largest, our most high demand program here is our registered nursing, more than our LPN, as we've seen the shift in the healthcare trends go towards that associate level and magnet status here in the Portland area anyway for the hospital. So that's why we started our RN to BSN program this past year. We're currently working on a BSN program that is a 37-month program from start to finish to have another option for students that want to go straight through. So our long-term, plans, whenever we get to that point of working through the current programs, is to offer nursing down the road to become degree granting down the road at that campus as well, and ultimately to offer bachelor's programs at some point. Here in the Portland campus, we're also in the beginning stages of working on an MSN program. We have a lot of our students, the majority of them come into our RN program. They have 2 or 3 years of prerequisites that they've been taking at community colleges to get into a nursing program. So we do want to be able to offer nursing down the road at some point in Arizona, yes.
Okay, well, great. And I just want to point out that our daughter's name is, her first name is Cascade. And so they have an affinity for you guys. So welcome to Arizona, assuming that you make all the changes to your catalog and enrollment agreement, and of course that we actually pass on this vote. Okay. Mr. Wallace, I'm going to turn it back to you to ask for a motion.
Can I make the motion? I think I can.
You can.
I'd like to make the motion to approve the transfer of ownership subject to the acceptance of the $15,000 surety bond requirement.
And I'll just add, to make the changes that were discussed with Dr. Lett.
Yes, thank you.
And I'll save time by seconding it. I, I saw the agenda, and I have a 1 o'clock tea time, so we're gonna have to move this along. No, I'm kidding. I don't play golf. That was just a joke.
You should.
Rachel, can we call the roll or call the vote?
Yes. Mr. Michael Monar, your vote.
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck.
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lupke.
Aye.
Mr. Scott Wallace.
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Mittman.
Aye.
Guys have it.
And Keith, I see that you raised your hand.
Yeah, Joanna or Tom, would you please send that update directly to me? Just email me the doc. I have all the notes of what Dr. Leck has requested.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Keith, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Is that better?
I'm sorry.
Sure.
And I think we need to ask, do you agree to whatever changes, the surety bond and also to make the changes?
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, we're good to go. Welcome to Arizona.
Yeah. Well, someone has to be here, right?
Thank you very much. I wish I was down there right now compared to the weather up here.
Yeah. Well, in the summer, we'll wish that we'll be up there with you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Next up, Arizona Medical Training Institute. Dr. Leck is lead on this, and Mr. LaMountain, can you give us a preview?
Sure. Dr. Mittman, members of the board, before the board today is a change of ownership for Arizona Medical Training Institute in Mesa, Arizona. The institution has been accredited has been licensed by the state since 2007. They offer non-accredited programs. A component to this to make sure and is to also understand that they do have programs that are outside of the two programs that we license. So they do offer additional programs that are licensed by other boards outside of this particular board. And again, your board member lead is Dr. Leck, and representing the institution is Mr. Clint Adair.
Thank you, Kevin. Would anyone from Arizona Medical Training like to make an opening statement?
No, I have no statement.
Okay. Well, thank you for making that very short. I'd like to express my gratitude for our executive director's misplaced trust in my skills to lead a change of control around the finances, not around the operations or the academics. So I'm just going to preface with that I'm going to rely on my fellow board members to dig through any of the financial information provided as part of this transaction. But I will do my best to ask informative questions regarding the operations, governance, and academics, which are more my specialty area. So I feel bad already. Kevin is and Keith are having to help me sort this out because I think the first thing I'm just trying to follow is that it appears there's two organizations, the Arizona Medical Training Institute and a something else and a
Yeah, that's correct. It's Arizona Medical Training Institute and Arizona Academy of Emergency Services. We've all been owned by the same company in the past. Ownership, you know, primary ownership's not changing. We've always operated independently, and that's still the plan going forward.
So then I look to Kevin, is this one or two entities?
The entity that is before you today is specifically Arizona Medical Training Institute.
Okie dokie.
But again, as Mr. Adair stated, that the institution itself, there was just really just a change in, and maybe Mr. Adair, you can explain it as well, but there's percentages that have changed in terms of the structure and the ownership. Do you want to walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. So the majority ownership hasn't changed. It remains the same for both entities. There was a new investment partner that came in. One of the partners was bought out and another one came in, but yeah, the CEO remains the same. All the directors and administrative staff at all the locations remains the same. There's been no substantial changes outside of that small, you know, minority owner that's changed and changed enough percentages that required a change of ownership application to be submitted.
Okay, so in the catalog, the student catalog, it said on the very first page, it's Arizona Medical Training Institute, but then right below it's Valley Vocational Academy. Is that a separate entity? Is it the same? What is, who
correct.
Is this?
That's another entity. That one operates a CNA program that's not overseen by this board.
Oh, that becomes very confusing. Okay. All right. So I'm trying to figure out my go through my questions then based on how I'm supposed to be looking at this. So if I remember correctly, I was looking at like your paramedic program. And it had a cost. I don't even know where it went. It had a cost for like an exam. It's like $150. But then another program has that exam for $300, or vice versa. Do you know what the difference is in those?
That exams? I do not know. Like I said, I operate the location here that does the phlebotomy program and the EKG program. I can bring up any specific questions on that specific program to the director of that location.
Great. And Dr. Leck, just, Mr. Chair, Dr. Leck, again, the interesting thing about this particular school is that we don't license a number of the programs that they have, and I believe that they have somewhat of a combined enrollment agreements and catalog,
yeah.
And that's where the challenge is, because that particular program we have nothing to do with. So the only two programs that are licensed by the institution are the EKG technician and the phlebotomy technician. Those are the only two programs.
The cardiographic one? No, not the cardiographic. Yes, the cardiographic one?
That's correct.
All right. I'm trying my best. I told you this was trying to sort this out. It's very confusing. Okay. So we oversee the cardiographic tech. Right. So I did have a question. You have a $200 administration fee for a $700 program. Seems pretty steep. Can I ask that question, Kevin?
You can ask whatever you want, Dr. Leck.
I thought that was a little bit rough. And then on top of that, you have a $50 withdrawal fee. So I know the other one is $200, but your other programs are in the thousands. So I was just thinking.
Yeah, the total cost of that program is $915. That, I guess that includes that administrative fee.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
All those programs, yeah, from the $1,000 up, we've kept that consistent with that $200. Anything that's below that has a different and a lower administrative fee.
Oh, I don't think I saw that. Well, that's because you guys are going back and forth, and I can't do that. Okay. You have for your phlebotomy, what is your clinical fee do? What is it used for?
For the administrative time to schedule using our My Clinical Exchange software.
Okay. And your supply fee, there's a supply fee, but your tuition says it includes supplies. So what's that?
That could probably be clarified. That means that that price is advertised all as one. So those supplies, anything that they're used in the lab is all included in that supply fee that they pay. There's no other supplies that they have to purchase.
Okay. Just a note, you have in there that students have, 7 days to pay before the interest accrues, but you guys have 30 days to refund. So if I was just looking at it, from the outside, that just seems kind of heavy on the student side. And then there was something, does a 3-day cancellation jive with the second bullet regarding cancellation, or do they need to add except Saturday, Sunday, and weekend? So you guys have a cancellation in here. It's either in the right enrollment book or, but I don't think it has the Saturday, Sunday, weekend language. Keith, it's in one place. It's right in another place, but there was one in here where I didn't think it was correct. Which I can let you guys know when I find it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to match that up if it's in one place and not the other. I can make those consistent.
Great. Thank you. So then it was just a clarification. I had a lot of clarification going, trying to understand the entities and what we were looking at and whatnot. So a lot of my questions were around that. There is in the board of directors that are listed in your handbook, it still has the Shanahans. I'm assuming they're coming out.
Correct. That will come out.
Okay.
The latest version.
And are the administrators still the same if the board of directors is incorrect? So, like, you have a section where it shows who the board of directors are and the administrators. Are the administrators the right people, or and just the board of directors is not right?
Yeah, just two of the board of directors are being replaced. All the administrators are the same.
So Dan, Clint, Lee, Nina, they're all there?
Correct.
Okay. On page 18, you guys call something a postgraduate, which I don't think should be the words you guys use. Postgrad is generally after, like, a postmaster's or afterwards, not this. So I think you guys probably want to find a different word for that, because these aren't even post-bac programs. And then I had a question, the previous school, and just because there were there were some similarities, the previous school had something about, like, nail length couldn't be more than a quarter of an inch past your finger or something. And yours wasn't as, precise as that, I believe. So is that a board of nursing rule that they get that, or did schools assign that?
A lot of that comes from the clinical contracts, what's required for the facilities that we go to and their standards.
Okay. All right. So it can change from one school to another. Okay.
Correct.
The other thing I saw was on your board of directors list for the application, there was only one person listed. Can you have a board of directors with one person?
I believe on the application, as I understood it, was people who had a certain percentage of ownership, and that was the only one that met that criteria.
I thought that was a different. I thought that was a different box. Maybe I'm wrong. Change of ownership. Let me see. It was. So one box says ownership is Frank at 32%, and then it says. List the board of directors or trustees, and there's one person. It says chairman of the board of directors, but it's only the person, one person listed.
I do see that. I will have to clarify that.
Okay. Hopefully my colleagues are impressed that I found something to do with the financial part. I think that's...
You hold it down.
I do what?
Said you hold a doctorate in education, and so if there's anybody who's going to find that pertains to the quality and the relations of education, we would count on you to do that.
See, that's what we need each other. I know this is going to be the strangest question, but I was just curious. The notary on this was in Ohio, so who's here and who's in Ohio?
The CEO, he resides in Ohio, but the schools are all located here in Arizona.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I think Dr. Swigert, maybe he was a resident here in Arizona when he started the Medical Training Institute, and I can't remember where I was reading it, but I know that he lives in Ohio, too.
Got it. All right, that's all the questions I have. Other board members, would you like to ask anything?
No, this is all you. Now that you're done with the the academic part, I'll let you take over the finances also.
You ready? Do you have money enough to pay for school for the next year?
So, I mean, I think feel free to jump in, either Mr. Wallace, Mr. Lubke, and Mr. Romano. But, based on the financials, the Arizona Medical Training Institute is profitable, has been profitable even during the past year during COVID, actually has a very high profit margin, and so from a financial standpoint, not an issue. Also, the ownership, I mean, it's a change of ownership, but it's really kind of a change of investors, you know, and some people are leaving, some people are coming in, but the person who was the primary owner remains the plurality owner. So I have no questions, and I'm comfortable with them continuing the good work that they're doing. Mr. Wallace or Romano or Lupke, questions on the finances or other questions that maybe Dr. Leck didn't cover?
This is Scott Wallace. I looked at the financials and didn't have any questions of any materiality.
No questions from me.
No questions here.
Yeah, really, Dr. Leck, you really could have gone out on a limb and said, you know, I've reviewed the financials and I with that. And then, you know, just kind of rolled the dice and the rest of us would have gone along. But I think that I think we're all comfortable and appreciate the submission and the amount of work that went into it.
Make sure you guys know how much I appreciate that side that you guys give. So I don't want to steal your thunder and make any comment that takes away your ability to comment.
Go ahead and make a motion.
Okay. I would like to make a motion to approve the change of ownership application, maintain a surety bond in the amount of $15,000, and to update the catalog with the new ownership and give it to staff to update along with some other recommended changes that I have lists for. Is that acceptable, Arizona Medical?
Yes.
Good. And we need a second.
This is Scott Wallace. I'll second that.
All right. Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none, Rachel, call the vote.
Yes, sir. Mr. Michael Mano, your vote?
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck?
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Maiman?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kearse. Okay, the ayes have it. Best wishes to all of you at Arizona Medical Training Institute.
Thank you.
All right. So moving along, we have initial applications. First up is Ocean Point Dental Academy, and our lead is Mr. Tharp. Mr. Tharp, take it away. Mr. LaMountain, can you give us an introduction, please?
I would love to, Dr. Mountain. Thank you. Appearing for before the board today is Ocean Point Dental Academy of Phoenix. The institution originally appeared before the board during the December 10th meeting, and due to a number of changes that were requested, we moved Ocean Point to the January 28th meeting. They're seeking a conditional non-accredited vocational license for the operations in Arizona to offer a 12-week dental assisting program. And representing the institution today are both Dr. Stephen Poulos and Mr. Bruce Vermeulen. And Dr. Mittman, I'm going to push this back to you if you don't mind.
Well, great. Dr. Poulos or Mr. Vermeulen, would you like to make an opening comment? And actually, I guess what I would prefer is if you could update us, because I recall from the December board meeting, there were a lot of change requests. And if you could focus on the changes that you made, that would be really helpful.
Dr. Poulos, do you want to give an intro?
Oh, Well, let me go ahead. Dr. Polis is not, I can see he's on there, but he's just muted it at the moment. I think just for the benefit of everyone, I'm a consultant to Dr. Poulos. I represent an organization, Medical Curriculum Partners. We license the curriculum to Dr. Poulos, and we use the brand name Ocean Point, and we use it in several states, you know, across the country. We will focus, and I'll certainly, Mr. Chairman, focus on the changes that we requested and what we addressed. Dr. Polis, are you there? Do you want to make any comments?
I believe I'm on. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I have to say that the angle that we're seeing you makes me feel like I'm in the operatory. So thanks for moving this way. I have enough anxiety going to visit my own dentist. So.
I can turn the camera off.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
So I'll let Bruce address most of all the technical details, and I can answer any questions in between.
Yeah, I think first of all we needed to clarify the number of hours of the course, because there seemed to be different documentation submitted to the board. And that's now been rectified, and there's two programs we're offering. One is the dental assisting program, and the other one is the dental receptionist. And those are clock hours of 202 hours for the dental assistant program and 134 hours for the dental receptionist program. So I think, you know, what had happened previously is that we sort of the application program that we submitted online got shut off, and then we sort of followed that up with paper, and I think that's where a lot of the confusion came in. Then there was the confusion, you know, we spoke about the externship and the 50 hours. I think everyone accepted that the 50 hours was appropriate for our short-term course. I think we just wanted to clarify that will take place subsequent to the students going through the entire program to meet the, you know, what a true externship is, where they will then go to other dental practices and with the skills that they've learned and the training they've learned or had, they'll be able to, you know, actually be functional in those practices. The third thing, I think we had one on the grievance policy. It looked like there was, you know, just a very long-winded sort of process in terms of there were many 7 days mentioned, and if you sort of totaled all those 7 days up, it looked like a very long time. So I've cleaned up the language. Basically, you know, the process will take place within 7 days. In other words, a meeting has to be set up within the 7 days, and then the board has exactly two days to get back to the student with the result of their hearing or their decision. So I think we cleaned that up. I'm trying to remember what the other, there was one other thing we needed to address. Oh, the actual sort of makeup and how much work they could miss. I've clarified that we previously had 5% in the documentation. That was pointed out that, you know, based on a 150 odd hours, that would be 7.5 hours, which was certainly on the sort of the lean side in terms, you know, from the student's perspective. I've increased that to 16 hours. So rather than putting a percentage, it's just a flat 16 hours. I think as discussed before, you know, students are graded every week. They're required to keep a certain grade point average. So that process is pretty robust. And the makeup work, you know, will be done within the week, or if not the week thereafter. I think those are all the changes, you know, having listened to the minutes and the audio recording of that. I think I've addressed the substantial changes that were requested.
Great. Well, thank you very much, sure. Both of you. Any questions from board members?
Dr. Medman, this is Mr. Liebke. Got a couple questions. Just to be clear, on the board report from staff, we're still showing the clinical externship hours to be 80 hours. Everything else in the documents show 50. So I don't know if that was from a previous version of their application.
Yeah, and if, Mr. Chairman, if I can address that, you know, what I was explaining earlier is it just was the process. We actually, you know, submitted everything online, and then there was a stage, because I think we had sort of gone over the time limit, that was shut off, and we then submitted, you know, paper documentation. But I can assure you it's 50 hours externship. That's what we're asking for, and that's what we're seeking approval for.
Okay, very good. Dr. Paulus, just a couple questions for you. Can you describe to the board a little bit about your practice, types of clients you have, and the types of dentistry you do there?
Yes, I've been in practice for 42 years now, so I've been blessed that I can do pretty much all phases of dentistry. We do crowns, bridges, implants, veneers, extractions, root canals, dentures, partials. We have 9 chairs. There's currently 2 other doctors besides myself working here. So we do have a pretty broad variety of exposure and experience.
Okay, very good. And that sort of ties into what I'm observing on your marketing brochures in terms of letting the students know that they'll be exposed to endodontics, orthodontics, and pediatric dentistry. You have a fair amount of pediatric clients?
You know, the pediatrics is not as robust as it has been in the past. I think people are having fewer children. So we do have a few every day, but, you know, it's not like it's being stormed by a bunch of kids. And we do the clear orthodontics. We don't do brackets, but I have done brackets before, and if anyone is interested in maybe a little sidebar, if they want to work in an ortho office, I can show them how to put brackets on and how to take them off.
Great. Well, thank you. On your brochure, you mentioned that the tuition includes lifetime job placement assistance, which is commendable. Can you tell me, when a student graduates from your program, what job placement assistance will you be providing?
Well, there's 3 agencies in town that I've worked with extensively to find dental assistants, so I have a good relationship with all of them. Princess Dental Staffing is one of the unique things that's been developed in Arizona. It's by a dentist that's kind of up the road from me, but he has a website. And you can list yourself either as a full-time applicant or as a temporary applicant. So if you list your resume in the full times, they enter the full resume, and then a number of dentists that subscribe to this site have the ability to look for someone. And with the current market, you know, unemployment being so lucrative, there's not a lot of dental assistants out there. With temporaries, when I looked for a temporary for myself, there's not too many on Monday through Thursday. There's more that show up on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay. So, you know, what the board tries to help, you know, new school applicants to kind of think through is those services that you don't have direct control over, which it sounds like in this case, you don't have somebody on your staff that'll be assigned with the responsibility to help students with their job placement. Sounds like you're sort of outsourced or you redirect. Having the statement on your marketing brochures is a bit misleading in that you really don't have control you're not really truly providing it there at the dental practice. Is that something you would consider taking off?
I'll let Bruce answer.
Sorry, if I can, Mr. Chairman, answer that. I think part I should add to that, I mentioned the MCP and Ocean Point. So we do this across the nation. So, and we work with a lot of dentists in multiple states, including we're about to launch, other practices in Arizona. But we do have in-house individuals that not only help students with resume, construction, and also we work with several of the staffing sort of agencies like Indeed to, these students. So there is that extra layer.
Can
again,
that
we
Steve
are,
is doing, I got a talk right now.
Again, we are a third party too, but we do work very closely with the dental practices that use our brand.
So Dr. Paulus, do you have a person assigned to job placement at the present time?
I work a lot with Christy at Dentattemp. So between Christy and Crystal, her right-hand assistant, it would be outsourced versus someone in the office. I can assign someone. I do have 14 staff members, so I could have someone say, okay, if this girl needs help getting connected, will you help her? And, I think that's a pretty easy thing to do.
All right. I just think that statement is a bit misleading. I don't think that if you're for the consultant who's setting these up throughout the state of Arizona, I would hate to see you lead your other clients to believe that that's sort of a legitimate claim that you can market on. If you don't have job placement assistance that you're providing directly from your business, then you probably should not put it way out in front on your marketing materials.
Sure, I agree.
Dr. Medman, those are the only questions I have.
Okay, thank you. Any other board members with questions?
This is Mike Romano. I do have a couple here that I want to kind of go through. Thank you for calling out the lifetime placement assistance as well. I think that's important. There's also a couple of places in your marketing where you refer to a rate, that a pay rate, but you don't call out any reference to where that's coming from. So we'd ask you to be very cautious if you're going to quote a particular hourly rate, that you would reference where you're getting that information from. And there are some areas in the marketing where it goes back and forth between a 12-week program and a 14-week program. So again, I'd ask you, we ask you to be clear on that. I guess ultimately I'm taking away a little bit too of, Mr. Vermillion, you're kind of the person who's bringing this opportunity forward to Dr. Paulus. And Dr. Paulus, you're looking to operate this type of business moving forward. When I look at the org chart that's provided, can you help me appreciate, I'm assuming you're the campus director, but who's the head instructor, assistant instructor, community liaison, and your admissions people?
Hey, how are you?
Chris, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, so head instructor, I would have one of my current assistants. I have Andriotta Slim and Fabiola Batista, who all had 8+ years of training. So I would appoint them and give them some extra hours and extra pay.
And are you managing admissions, or is this part of a centralized group that's managing admissions? How's that overseen?
Yeah, I believe Bruce would be the key person on admissions, but I would be doing a review of all the applicants, and then we'd be teaming together to select the ones that are eligible. And
Correct. So there's two aspects here. Number one, it's definitely done through the dental practice itself. So someone there would give them a campus tour and take them through the documentation. We do train Dr. Carlos's staff to do that, but that's very much their responsibility to execute that on campus once, you know, student has taken a tour and gone through all the, you know, the catalog and the enrollment agreement. What we do is we help significantly, not only with the marketing, so that's key, and then also getting the students financed, you know, through the finance company. So we've got the relationship there that we help the students get financed. And Mr. Chairman, if I can also address the previous, you know, point on the marketing material, I do believe I addressed both those points on the rate and resubmitted new documentation for examples of our marketing material.
Great. I'm just referring to what was included in the folder itself as I went through it. But yeah, that's great that you've recognized it and possibly already addressed it. Who is responsible for, I guess, overseeing the instruction that's given to verify or validate that the students have actually received the education that's being offered here?
Yeah, I'm sort of the ultimate backstop, and I think it's like asking questions and doing you know, kind of a forum, you know, do you understand what we mean by this? Does this make sense to you? Here's how you seat the patient. Here's how you bib the patient. Your main thing with suctioning is to make the patient comfortable, but also you're protecting the airway. You're making sure that no debris goes down their throat, that kind of thing. And then when the doctor's doing an injection, here's the steps that he's going to take. Here's what you look for just in case there's an odd reaction. Observe the patient, you know, just getting them tuned into all of the things that happen sort of as we go through treating patients.
So I'm just talking out loud here respectfully, and I understand there's an opportunity here as it seems as though these are becoming a little more commonplace, kind of almost like a franchise, I would say, of, hey, I have a practice. I'd like to offer education. You have a model that I can follow to execute against that. I just want to have a level of confidence that, Dr. Polis, that you're recognizing what you're really stepping into and the accountability necessary to the students in receiving that education that I think up until this point, there's probably some belief on either Mr. Vermillion's side or Dr. Polis' side of division of responsibilities and what that looks like. I would just ask that you really be very clear of what you're signing up for and what you're about to impact on a consumer's experience with education, and that you feel confident that you can execute at a high level in the delivery and oversight of that education. Is that your position, Dr. Poulos, that you can bring that level of quality education and oversight?
Yes, it is. You know, dentistry is my passion. You know, I'm a kind of guy that I work 7 days a week, you know, not that I need to, it's just that I love it. And I've got a team that's been with me, you know, some of my staff members have been with me over 25 years. So I think with that kind of group around me, I know we'll get the job done. You know, if I say, okay, ladies, we've got this responsibility, and I've got men also. My one son works for me, and he's been trained both in front office and back office. And, you know, he wants his days off, but, you know, if I need him, he'll be there. My wife's worked with me for the last 40 years. So it's a family thing. So, you know, we're kind of dedicated. Unless we get hit by a bus, the show's going to go on.
I'll leave it with, I know in my background, I have training and experience that I could provide that education to somebody else. The question becomes consistently over time following the protocols that are put in place versus subjectively determining that a student either meets or does not meet the expectation. So I'll accept the fact based on the information that you've provided here that you understand the responsibility of what you are signing up for in delivering that type of consistent education that results in somebody being able to have gainful employment out there in the marketplace. And that's all the questions I have.
Okay. Yeah, I do. And listening to the whole board meeting this morning, I can see some of the things that come up and like with the schools going under, but you know, I'm in a position that I'm pretty solvent. I'm able to continue this. And, you know, I frankly see it as a great opportunity if I step down from chair side of spending more time educating.
Thank you for that.
So just to kind of follow up on some of Mr. Romano's questions, some of the roles and functions that you were describing, Dr. Poulos, that will fall to various staff members, are they reflected, I'm looking at some of the financial projections and the budgets, are they reflected in the salaries? So are these planned expenditures, or are these going to be kind of on-the-fly adjustments to people's current salaries?
You know, I think some are planned, and I think others are going to be adjusted as we get enrollment. So as the enrollment goes up, you know, right now everyone's out there collecting unemployment, and they're afraid to get a job because they'll lose their unemployment, which is almost as good as pay in some areas. But I think as we wind down from COVID and start rolling forward, you know, maybe in September, October, November, people are going to be looking for jobs, and they're going to be wanting training, and then they might get training while they're waiting for their job. They've got time on their hands, and they've got income,
right,
which
right.
Very seldom they do.
About the students, I'm talking about your staff.
Oh, my staff, yes.
Currently working for you and probably loving their jobs, and all of a sudden they're going to find themselves in the post-secondary education field.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can answer that or just add to that, you know, one of the things setting up and the model with the dental sort of practice is that the employees are typically on a 1099 basis, and all of the costs that you spoke about are included in the forecast. Bearing in mind this is a very small school, so you're looking at, you know, something like 8 to 14, 15 students per quarter, and that's probably, you know, what you're looking at. So the good thing is that Dr. Poulos has the infrastructure and the staff members that are prepared to do this on, you know, a contract basis. And, you know, if you take whether it's the lecturers or the person helping with the enrollments and the admin or the student services, we have built in what we think is a reasonable cost for that based on the volumes that we expect.
I think that the people that Dr. Poulos is referring to who are going to be providing a lot of the instruction are not 1099. Those are his employees.
Yes.
It would probably be problematic for them to be contracted labor. And so these are people who have a job. They probably are hourly wage employees who are, and I guess here's the question that I have. Mr. Vermeulen, your compensation in this model, you know, if everything works out, you know, and all the numbers are there, at, let's say, I think 60 students per year.
Yes.
Right? For both programs or one program?
That's for the dental assisting program.
Right. And then another 60 for the receptionist.
Probably fewer than that, so, yeah.
Okay. So let's say 100 students per year.
Yes.
Right? And so for Dr. Poulos, you know, you love dentistry, you love teaching people, you know, you probably, you know, people who come to work for you probably came with a baseline skill set, and by the time, you know, several months go by, I'm sure that you and your staff impart a lot of wisdom and experience, so they get better. However, that's not the same thing as 100 people coming through your practice year after year. And not only is it on you, but it's on all of your employees who are, you know, they're not, I mean, they're trained to do the job that they do, which is great for your patients, but they're not trained as instructors. And it's one thing, and circling back to what Mr. Romano was saying, it's one thing to be able to show someone how to do something and to be there and to be patient and everything, but assessing all of those people so that, you know, it's likely that out of 100 people in a year, some people aren't going to make it through the program. And so, you know, having the experience to do that is different when you are scaled up to the levels that are in the performers that you presented here. And I guess I would throw it kind of in Mr. Vermeulen's lap is for your company that is roughly, you know, as a consultant here on an ongoing basis, what's your responsibility to provide the post-secondary education framework so that Dr. Poulos and his other doctors and his staff don't, I could say this because I have gray hair too, don't get more gray hair or stressed out or, you know, it's a lot, and a dentist office is busy by, I mean, that's a busy enterprise, you know, already. And so what does, what does MCP do to ensure the quality of the education and prevent Dr. Poulos and his staff from kind of burning out,
right,
taking on something that is rather ambitious?
Right. Okay. Yeah, if I can address that. A couple of things, Mr. Chairman. One is that, we provide all the platforms. Dr. Poulos himself is on our advisory board, so we've got 10 dentists on the advisory board, so the curriculum is constantly revised and looked at, and we get feedback from multiple schools across the country, so I think that's key. The second point I wanted to make, clarify, you spoke about the dental practice and the school, and we purposely get the dental practice to set up a separate LLC, and that's so it's Ocean Point Dental Academy is a separate legal entity that will contract with preferably staff that he currently has that wish to do it, or it would be someone outside. For instance, we've got many schools that the dental assistants and staff don't want to be involved. They don't need the extra hours. They don't want, to do the additional work. And they employ an outside instructor. Now, I also want to point out that it is outside the, normal office hours. So that's intentional. So that's, the one program's run on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, from 6 until 10. And then the other program, the receptionist program, is run on Saturdays, 8 to 5. So we try and keep those two things absolutely separate. The sort of overlap is when, the dental practice would contract as one of the externships, for instance, and that's a separate agreement between the two as well. In terms of even using the practice, there's a usage agreement between the dental practice and the school so that these two things are kept, absolutely separate.
So that's what you were talking about, staff. So these are staff. They may work in Dr. Poulos' practice.
Yes.
And then this work is separate, during separate hours completely.
Yes.
Although students will probably be shadowing them during their internship.
Well, there's two different
hours, 50 hours that we talked about earlier.
Yes, so there's two components. There's going to be the clinical, which is 2 hours per week. So those will be staff members of the practice. And then you've got the externship, which will mainly be done at other sites. And you're really just looking at 4 or 5 students maximum actually doing their externship in Dr. Polis's dental practice. The other students will be going to total third parties, if you like, or unrelated parties, probably a better word, to do the externship.
Okay. Other board members?
Yeah, Dr. Mibben, I have a question for Mr. Vermeulen. So you've got a rather elaborate website set up.
Yes.
You would lead the reader to believe that you're licensed in 35 states, including the one that this board represents, and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. Furthermore, your website says that you have 99% completion rate. That means only one out of 100 students would drop out. And that you have a placement rate of 97%. Those figures are rather lofty and a little bit hard to believe, I suppose. I'll just be blunt.
Right.
And it's, I guess I would say it smacks of being a bit misleading, but perhaps you could speak to those two.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, I'm not an owner of NCP. I'm a contractor to them to help them get the schools licensed. So I'll certainly take that up with NCP themselves and the comments that you've made. We're currently working on, I think, over 80 schools that are in different stages of licensing. I wasn't aware that Arizona's up there stating that it's actually a licensed school at this point. So we'll make sure that's rectified.
It's okay. It doesn't. It says coming soon.
Yes.
You know, Dr. Mibben, if you look under locations, it shows that they have locations in Arizona.
Right.
That to mean that they've got permission to operate in Arizona.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just scrolling through. I see what you're saying. I think it says our campus is about to open at your location. So let's see. Okay.
I'll certainly take it up with the principals.
Yeah. To your point, Mr. Lubke, because I can't remember how many, but I know that we license several dental assisting programs that operate out of individual practices, right? But from a scale standpoint, they're fairly small, right. And the way Dr. Poulos was describing the way that he would envision working sounds like some of the other some of the other schools that we already license. What you're pointing out about Ocean Point Dental Assisting Academy, it almost, it kind of takes that and blows it way up. And it's one thing to have, the website and to have the kind of like, here's the sort of like the franchise launch your business package. It's another thing to actually sustain a school at the proposed level, which I think is different than what we've seen in these small you know, practice-based schools. It almost approaches the scale that we see for health profession, allied health profession schools that have all of the other infrastructure in place to do, to do the, not just the instruction, but the assessment and all of the support that goes along with it.
Well, I think if they were an accredited school, they would be held to a much higher standard in terms of what they represent themselves to be. It seems that they are flying somewhat under the radar as a national entity and rolling up all their numbers to report that somehow they're just about near perfect in terms of graduating students.
Mm-hmm.
And 97% placement. And by the very nature of the limited amount of training these students are getting, that becomes even more difficult to believe that to be possible. And I don't know. I think as a state board, we should hold them accountable to publish their own statistics as to placement and completion. But to be able to hold out to the general public that they're able to do, you're almost guaranteed of completing, and you're nearly guaranteed of job placement. If you're going to quote 99%, 97%.
As I say, Mr. Chairman, I'll address that with the others and see what supports that data. I know there's probably 15 to 20 licensed schools, and see that the data supports what the claims that they're making. But I think that's a fair comment.
I apologize. This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I'm having a really hard time understanding people that are speaking.
Yeah, could everyone
There's a lot of background noise.
Mute. And whoever's got the a lot of background noise.
I think it's Dr. Polo. So I can see it moving. So if you could mute until you want to talk. Perfect. Thank you, sir.
To Mr. Lukey's point, I guess we need clarification because, Mr. Vermeulen, you said 40 some odd schools, but there's 72 campuses nationwide. So there's a lot there. And yet Ocean Point Dental Academy here in Arizona is solely owned by Dr. Poulos, right?
Correct.
And so in some sense, the marketing goes through Ocean Point as a national, like the top of the funnel. I'm looking at the website now. We're national, we're nationwide, and it would direct I imagine that the marketing would come through here. It directs people to the Arizona school. But what the public and prospective students see is Ocean Point. But who oversees Ocean Point as a whole? Because otherwise, from an accountability standpoint, how are we able to protect the public? Because it seems like the communications that happen are sort of outside of, in this case, Dr. Poulos's, direct control and therefore our authority as as a regulatory body.
And Mr. Chairman, I think key to understand is first of all, the Ocean Point brand is offered to help the schools generate extra business. When someone Googles, you quickly found Ocean Point and you find someone that's in Arizona. I think your point's very valid. That's a branding issue. Legally, we have no ownership in the school. Secondly, each school, Dr. Polis is totally responsible for his own school. And, I think he'll attest to that, that he understands that he runs the school, he is a director, we provide certain platforms, training, and assistance to that, and Dr. Pulis understands the Ocean Point brand. He's on the advisory board. And also the initial contract's only for less than a year. So Dr. Pulis, after 6 months, could say, I'm not going forward with the Ocean Point brand, and make the necessary adjustments. Some of our schools have chosen to do that, and we have an arrangement that they use the curriculum and they don't use the Ocean Point brand. They use their own brand. Most of our schools don't even have, we set it up, the LLC, as a different name to Ocean Point. They just do business as Ocean Point so that they can use the branding. But the legal entity is owned by the dentist. We have no ownership in that whatsoever. But I do understand the board's concern that it looks like it's a national thing. This was challenged quite extensively in the state of Florida, and we submitted all the contracts and that to them because they thought this looked like a franchise, and they came away and have licensed, one school and about to license a second one in the state of Florida. So I think we're very clear to separate those. I think Mr. Lukey's point is absolutely valid. We cannot have anything from any point of view that's not truthful in that. And I will also reflect, the board sentiment on this, that the Arizona, is licensed in the state of Arizona, and any claims that are made must be specific to the states, and it's a responsibility of Dr. Polis. All the marketing documentation is sent to him for his approval. So ultimately, he answers to the board. We just give him the brochures, and he doesn't even have to use the website if he chooses not to. We just provide that service to them.
Mr. Vermilion, when does your responsibility end in this effort with Dr. Pulis upon gaining state approval?
No, so we have a contract for 1 year with Dr. Pulis. So what we do is two things: that we help them maintain their status and meet, continue to meet the regulatory compliance of Arizona. So that's one thing. And even, we do offer things where we've got a CPA that we work with that, helps them do their accounting if they want to use those services. I think Dr. Pulis is fine. He's one of his staff members, does all his accounting for him. So we're really just trying to provide the services, the platform, the marketing, if they need it. If they don't need it and they stand alone, that's also good. As I said, some schools have even gone to the extent that they just license the curriculum and pay us a fee for doing that.
And so when does that year expire?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't say.
I interrupted. Go ahead, Mr. Romano.
When does that year expire?
Dr. Polis, I'm not sure if you started this process, so that's probably coming up pretty soon, the expiration of that.
I don't know if he's on.
And yeah, I think he started about a, you know, close to a year ago.
And the fee is 20% of what? Of gross revenues? Of
net.
Profit? So 20% of net.
Yes.
And once it's operating, what support does MCP provide? So you mentioned marketing.
Right.
Right. What else?
So we offer them the, first of all, the licensing of the curriculum, which is, you know, updated each year. The ongoing regulatory support. So it's not only the initial application, but, you know, a lot of the schools are now into the second phase where we're meeting, you know, quarterly and other reporting deadlines, you know, to those states. So we do that. And then, you know, obviously there's things like the grading platform that we offer, and we oversee that because, you know, if Dr. Paulus doesn't keep up with his grading, you know, we see that, and we immediately contact the school and say, you're required to, you know, weekly grade these students and the attendance registers and everything else. So that's the service that we provide to them. You know, a big part of it is marketing.
Okay. So I see three choices. So this is an initial application. So this would be provisional, right?
Conditional.
Conditional, sorry. So number one is to approve, and it's for a year. So the school would come back in a year. And if there are issues, you know, we don't renew or we don't move from conditional to full approval. That's number one. Number two is we just say, no, we're not going to approve this. And then the third begs the question, is there additional information that the board needs to choose door number one? Approve the provisional as opposed to no, this doesn't seem right. And so I guess I just want to ask the board members, is there additional information that you feel that you need? Because I mean, if there isn't, you know, we just have to make a decision, you know, either, you know, kind of go with it and see you know, how things turn out over the year, and which means that we have enough information to know that whoever enrolls in the program is going to be well served. Or is there anything else, further clarification, similar to in December, that's required to get to that point? If not, you know, then we have door number three, which is, you know, just not approved.
Dr. Mittman, I would, and I'll, if we were to make a motion on this, I would probably ask that we have that contract demonstrating through this first year of operation between the two entities. There just seems to be a divide, and I would be very concerned if we approve now and Dr. Paulus does not renew his agreement with this entity, resulting in a crash and burn type of scenario. So I think if we were to make a motion to approve, that motion would need to include a secured contract through the duration of the first year of operation that corresponds with the licensing, the conditional license, to support that.
So what I'm hearing is that the application came to us as Ocean Point, which was really the combination of two entities, Dr. Poulos and Ocean Point, as the consulting arm. And that if we were to approve it, we're approving it for a year, that with the expectation that the two of them stay married for that year. Mr. Monahan, are we allowed to require that?
Chair Mittman, right?
You know, off the top of my head, that's actually a bigger issue. That's something that I would have to look into. You know, I don't think that we have the authority to require two parties to enter into a contract or remain in a contract for licensure purposes.
Okay. So it sounds like, Mr. Romano, that we can't make that requirement today. So that means that we could either task the assistant AG to get clarification on that, and we would have to come back in February, or you know, you're just SOL, and there's no, and we're not going to do that.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
Chairman, Chair Mittman, Member Romano, this is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General again. You could just move this to the February meeting, and during that time, we could, you know, be given the documentation for the contracts and allow us to review that to see what kind of liability we'd be opening ourselves up to.
Okay. So that, we could do that. Either Mr. Romano or other board members.
Mr. Lipke has his hand up.
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Mittman, I think at the present time I would vote no unless they can decouple themselves from the advertising that Ocean Point is doing nationwide. They don't seem to have any control over what's being broadcast in terms of completion rates and placement rates. If they were able to somehow disavow themselves of that relationship, that I would be comfortable. It would be more consistent with the dental practices that we have licensed to date, where they're providing dental training in their dental practices and providing their own sort of mom-and-pop marketing strategies. But right now, I don't have any concerns about Dr. Paulus. And forgive me for mispronouncing your name.
Sorry, I don't think he's on. Can call him whatever we want.
Okay. Well, I have no doubt that with 42 years experience, docs in the office, plenty of operatories that he can deliver what he says he wants to deliver. Other than most of us who are serving in the school industry know, 99% completion rate is. It might be the true definition of puffery. 100% satisfaction rate is the other claim on the website, and the 97% placement rate. So, if they could divorce themselves from that sort of marketing practice, then I would vote yes. That's all I have.
Okay, so it sounds like there's two tasks moving forward. One is for Ocean Point Dental Academy to submit the documentation to Assistant AG Monahan to review, and then the other is to address Mr. Lupke's concern about these either. You know, some of these claims around completion and also satisfaction and probably placement as well. Anyone else on the board? Okay, are there any other issues that we haven't addressed? Okay, so Mr. LaMountain, do we need to make a motion to bring this to the February meeting and for Ocean Point to follow up with documentation for the assistant AG and to address the concerns around completion, satisfaction, and placement.
Seamus, did you want to say something? I saw that you.
No, I think that was a good motion. No, I didn't have anything to add at this time.
Right. So then what we would do, Dr. Mittman, is make a motion to push this forward to potentially into the February meeting. We will certainly meet with Mr. Vermeulen and Dr. Polos to work on the issues that were brought up by the board and make a determination from staff if we were to move forward in February or thereafter to make sure that your requirements are met.
Okay. Well, if Ms. Kearse is good with the motion that I informally made, since Mr. Monahan gave it a good grading.
Dr. Mittman, could you, at least for me, get real super clear of what the motion is and what you're requiring and what we should be expecting from the institution in the next 30 days?
I thought you said it was a good motion.
I loved your motion.
He doesn't agree with me, apparently.
I'm a little slow.
All right. So I will move that Ocean Point that we we will table this decision until the February meeting, before which Ocean Point Dental Academy will submit the contract between Ocean Point and Dr. Poulos for review by the assistant to the assistant AG, and that Ocean Point meet with staff to address concerns around completion rates, job placement, and student satisfaction.
Dr. Mittman, just a point of clarification, if we could potentially strike the February, because I don't know that future, this will all be done by the future, a future date.
And so if that's good, Mr. Before we get a second on that, Mr. Lukey, did that motion capture all of your the issues that you raised?
Yeah, so as I understand it, you're asking them to provide the contract so we can review and then also address their connection to the nationwide marketing of Ocean Point.
Okay.
Dr. Mittman, if I could ask for one amendment to that, which would be a clear delineation of responsibilities between the two entities.
Okay. Just since it hasn't been seconded, we're not even going to amend that. That is part of the motion. All right, if we have all of those components are good, now can I get a second?
Dick Lupke, second.
Great, thank you. All right, any further discussion? Ms. Kearse, could you please call the vote?
Yes, sir. Mr. Mike Romano?
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck?
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lupke?
Aye.
Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Mittman?
Aye.
Perfect. Eyes have it.
This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. Just a point of clarification. The contract does not have to be sent directly to me. It can be sent to Kevin, and then I'll get together with Kevin.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Paul.
All right, moving on to United States University. Our lead is Mr. Romano. I'm going to ask Mr. LaMountain to give us an introduction, please.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Mittman, members of the board. Before the board today is the initial application for United States University for a regular accredited vocational and degree program. The United States University is currently approved by the state of Arizona, by our board, for an administrative site at 4605 East Elwood in Phoenix. The site currently provides operational aspects of the university, including enrollment management, academic advisement, and a number of others. They are looking to have United States University as Arizona as their home state. Representing the institution today is Dr. Steve Stargardner and Dr. Joanne Weiss.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. LaMountain. This is Michael Romano, and thank you very much, United States University, for joining us today, and also considering making Arizona your home state. So that's tremendous to hear. Would you like to start with an opening statement?
Yes, please. This is Steve Stargardner, a very brief opening statement. First of all, thank you so much for meeting with Joanne and myself today. Just a little bit of timeline context, if I could, please. Aspen Group, Inc. Acquired United States University in 2017. That acquisition was approved by the Regional Accreditor Department of Education and all other administrative offices, if you will. Since that time, our staff, if you will, has been split between offices in Phoenix and offices in San Diego. There are now more staff in Phoenix than in San Diego. And even at that time, we started talking about, if you will, combining all of our staffs into one location. Because, as you're probably aware, California is a non-SARA participant, the university has sought approval and received approval in 42 states individually to offer various programs. Joanne has really spearheaded that effort, and also 8 territories. I shouldn't forget the 8 territories. So we have done each of those individually. Earlier last year, as a member of this committee mentioned or alluded to, the regional accreditors announced an intention, now institutional accreditors, announced an intention to accredit schools in states other than the traditional geographic region. I made an initial inquiry of our accreditor, the Western Association. They indicated that yes, they would accredit an institution in Arizona. So if in fact this approval goes through its course and all regulatory agencies approve, United States University would maintain its WASC accreditation with its campus address location being in Phoenix. So just by way of context, all programs are online. They would be continued to be offered. Faculty are dispersed in addition to Phoenix and San Diego throughout the United States. They would continue to teach. Administrators would continue to administer. I would move to Phoenix to our new campus, but in terms of the teaching and learning of the university, all would remain constant. And just wanted to provide a little context on that. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. And just to clarify, is all of that delivery online, or is it actually some of it done at the campus?
Yes. So since the onset of COVID-19, every aspect of the university, both educational and administrative, has been online. The major campus-based activity, if you will, would be immersion weekends for the nursing program, where students up until last March would fly to San Diego for a 4-day immersion, clinical immersion on campus. When COVID-19 hit and we all closed campuses, we pivoted very quickly. And those immersions are now virtual. Everything is done virtually. And what that will look like in the post-COVID-19 world, I can't fully say yet, but we hope to be able to return that experience to campus as soon as it's safe, as soon as it's feasible. But we also intend to continue offering virtual opportunities for students.
I'd like to add one more piece to that, the answer of that question. Those immersions that occur are by cohort, and we have received from Arizona Private Post-Secondary approval to host those at the location that we have here in Phoenix already. Additionally, the program in which those immersions are located is the Master of Science in Nursing Family Nurse Practitioner Program, and it has been approved in Arizona by the Arizona Board of Nursing. So I just wanted to add one more piece on the regulatory side there.
Thank you, Dr. Weiss. I only have a few questions, and then I'll turn it over to my fellow board members. It looks as though you're anticipating some pretty healthy growth in enrollments as well as revenue as you lead into 2021 here. And I just wanted to verify that and I guess better understand what's giving you that confidence level of that type of growth.
I'd like to speak to that if I could, Joanne, and then anything you'd like to add, by all means. So the USU fiscal year, as you probably see there, runs from May 1st to April 30th of the next year. So we are actually approaching the end of fiscal year 21 and are in the midst of planning or the beginning of planning for fiscal year 22. When we were planning for fiscal year 21, the first stages of COVID had hit. And I'll speak just for myself in that process. I really anticipated a slowdown of enrollments. I anticipated fewer new students. I didn't even begin to understand the disruptive nature, the tragic nature of COVID-19. I was pretty certain, though, that our growth would be slowed down pretty materially. In fact, what happened, and much of this is anecdotal information, so this is much more qualitative than quantitative. We've seen a couple of kind of intersecting developments. One, nurses that are not ER nurses, intensive care unit nurses, many of our students have found themselves either being laid off or their hours diminished as their facilities pivot to COVID-19 treatment. That means that they've actually accelerated degree programs, they've taken more credits per session, and they are moving more rapidly to their degree program. In fact, this session, in the midst of COVID, the university will graduate 98 students. Last session, it graduated 133 students, and that 133 number is notable because that's the largest amount of students, about 90% of them MSN FMP students, that the university has ever graduated in its history, insofar at least as I could tell. We are also seeing an acceleration of students, RNs, if you will, BSNs, seeking that MSN FMP degree, that's obviously our largest program, to either join a clinical practice as an FMP or to begin their own clinical practice and making, if you will, undertaking a migration from their current career track to another career track still within nursing. So, in fact, we are seeing that growth, we're anticipating that growth, And those two factors are really, I would say, the major two factors behind what we are seeing at the university.
Thank you. In regards to Aspen and USU, what portion of the revenue or size are you of Aspen as a whole?
So United States University currently contributes 29% of the revenue of Aspen Group, Inc. USU is a much smaller university, for instance, than Aspen University. When I checked yesterday, United States University had a student population of 2,086 students. That may have changed by one or two today, but that's what it was as of yesterday. And as I say, directly to your question, it contributes 29% of the revenue as a whole of Aspen Group Inc.
And it's just based on the financials that were provided. Aspen has experienced losses over the last couple of years, if I'm reading that right, where it looks like USU is financially profitable. Is that correct?
It is trending toward financial profitability. I think that's best put. I'll be able to give you a much better answer to that question, or this board a much better answer, once we've closed FY21. What we're projecting, again, as of about 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon, for FY21, we're projecting $19,978,000 in revenue and expenses of $16,257,000, but that is pre-amortization, depreciation, and all of those calculations. But yes, I feel confident that the university will, in fact, be in a good financial position at the end of this fiscal year.
But that is not. Is that also the case for Aspen as well, then?
Joanne, you want to handle that?
Yeah, thank you. The short answer is yes. With USU profitable, we are expecting that group will be profitable as well.
Okay, thank you. And it may be necessary, Dr. Stargardner and Dr. Weiss, when either of you are talking, to mute the other one to avoid the echo.
Sorry about that. Yeah,
no worries. So as we go through, just a couple of other things of notice that I had. The enrollment agreements that were at least provided to us are referencing California versus that of Arizona, and in even those enrollment agreements, little things like the page numbers were all the same. That may have just been in the documents provided. I'm just sharing that with you for awareness there, in case there is something more that you need to look at for that. It would appear that in your rights to cancel, you use a little different approach. You throw out 7 days. Where we traditionally see you have 3 days excluding weekends and holidays. I didn't know if there was any particular reason why you take that approach, and maybe you could just briefly explain that.
I think that the easiest answer to that is that we are right now, those enrollment agreements are sitting under the requirements of the Bureau of Private Postsecondary in California, and we will be changing that as we move forward.
Okay. Mr. Blanchard, did you have, look like you had raised your hand. I don't know if you had something additional to add.
Yes, Mr. Romano. Since this is an administrative center, they have to meet their home state licensing requirements. So like the catalog and the enrollment agreement wouldn't be ours. They would just need to submit it so we have it on file. But it wouldn't have to meet our standards, it'd have to meet California standards. Terry, am I right in that? Is that still accurate?
However, Keith, in this case, they are moving their institution to be Arizona.
Yeah. That was my question. I had it on there. It was all the materials reflect. And I could tell that they all reflect California. So when I'm looking at the policies and stuff, I don't know how to tell whether they're going to be updated for Arizona rules.
Yeah, the application that's in our system is administrative center. It's not a degree granting application, unless it's changed and I've missed it.
Hi, this is Carrie. No, this is a separate application where they are moving from California to Arizona. So they would, at least once they've been approved, need to submit an updated enrollment agreement and catalog with our requirements instead of the Bureau's.
Then my question goes to, if they're approved today, how do we review those things like we do all other schools? How does that work?
I guess your choice would be to direct staff to review it, mm-hmm. or to postpone and ask them to resubmit and review that at your next meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Just a couple other things. I noticed as well, and this may just be because of the California expectations versus that of Arizona, in regards to the withdrawal percent, it's not called out like as a student progresses through by percentage, what percent and how it's kind of prorated. It's just kind of a flat statement that says you will be prorated. Between once after you start to before you finish. And so again, that may just be the California expectation versus the Arizona. I don't want to say as strongly as expectation, but there are at least statutes that do call out what that percentage is to be. So I think that would also need to be reflected appropriately.
We can certainly do that for you, Mr. Romano.
Thank you.
This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. There also is another option. The board could direct staff. The board could approve the license pending receipt of the Arizona-specific catalog and enrollment agreement. And if it's up to the board staff standards, then you could allow them to approve it.
Thank you, Attorney General. I appreciate it, Assistant Attorney General. Okay, that was really all my questions there. I thought overall you did a nice job putting the information together. I understand the nuances of the California versus Arizona piece of it, but that's all I have. Are there any other board members with any additional questions?
I know I have. I had a couple. So a lot of the things we talked about so far cleared up some of the ones that I had, but when I look at what you guys are proposing as far as moving your whole organization here, so that means all the people that are currently in San Diego will be relocated here, correct? You're not keeping anything in California?
That's correct. There are approximately 15 people in San Diego now that would be relocating. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so when I look in the submissions that you gave, I open up a floor plan, and if I'm not incorrect, I think this was supposedly about 9,000 square feet of space. Most offices, cubes, and other infrastructure needed for the staff. My question becomes, where are classes? So I don't see any classrooms there in what you submitted.
I can answer that, if that's okay, Steve. There's a first floor that is already been approved as the location for where the immersions would take place. There are no other classrooms that are necessary because it is it's an online institution. And that space on the first floor has already been approved for those immersions.
Okay.
which, by the way, are 2.5 days out of a program for those students.
Okay. All righty. I just thought, so we have the resumes in the system, and I did, this has caught me kind of funny, and I just was curious about it. Your CFO has a bachelor's in philosophy. And even when you look at the resume, it's not a huge financial background. And I was just, this leads me to my next question, because I don't think I've ever seen that. But unless I'm reading this wrong, the parent company had 2 years of financial loss. And I guess I'm looking to my counterparts who are the guys, the money guys, you guys are the money guys, whether or not that's a problem. Does that affect anything? So kind of twofold. A CFO who has a bachelor's of philosophy, so no CPA or anything. Does that make anyone nervous? Makes me curious.
As long as he's not working for me, I'm fine.
could I address that just for a moment, please? I had never seen that either. So that makes two of us. When I interviewed Ming, I learned about his background. He, in fact, has a baccalaureate in philosophy from Northwestern University. That being said, he was very interested. He is a finance person, as you can see from the resume, having worked at banks, lending houses, and two regionally accredited WASC institutions. He is very, very strong in terms of zero-based budgeting, in terms of proper accreditation standards, and he works very closely with the corporate director of accounting, corporate chief financial officer. And I can attest to the fact that he provides United States University with every level of financial oversight that is required of a regionally accredited school.
Okay, so that I'm just going to log that. It makes me nervous. Even when I look at the history, even based on what you're saying, a lot of it is like financial planning versus accounting practices. And so I guess I'm with Rick on that one, but we'll leave that where it is. But the other part of that with the 2 years of parent loss, is that an issue?
I think Aspen University is on, are they on quarterly reporting? We see them frequently. And so Aspen, you know, when I saw the agenda with USU, I pulled up some of my Aspen documents. So Aspen has lost money for several years.
Dr. Weiss, you had just stated that based on this upcoming financials that it was moving to a profitable situation.
Yes, and I would want to clarify that Aspen University as an entity in and of itself has always been profitable. Aspen Group has suffered a bit with the acquisition of USU several years ago, and now we are trending up not only for USU's financials to be in the black, AGI's as well by the end of this fiscal year. We're expecting that in a few months.
Are there any other questions? Well, if not, I would like to make a motion that we approve the regular accredited vocational degree program licensing application with the stipulation of the $15,000 surety bond is maintained and also pending staff review and approval of an EA and catalog meeting Arizona requirement.
I will second that. Paul Mittman.
Is there any further discussion? And do you folks at USU agree to the stipulations?
We do, yes.
Okay. All right, Ms. Kearse, would you call the vote?
Of course. Mr. Mike Romano, your vote?
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck?
Aye.
Mr. Dick Lukey?
Aye.
Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Mittman?
Aye. And I could for staff just find out if I misspoke on Aspen University showing losses the last several years. Please let me know, and I will correct that so that it doesn't go on record when we accept the minutes for the next time.
On record, you're correct.
I'm sorry?
You are correct. And we do have an agreement with them. They've been providing records and such. So
okay, so we do have a stipulated agreement.
We do.
Okay, so yeah, so Aspen University has shown losses the last several years. And so let the record reflect it. So, we welcome all of you coming from San Diego. I would say the weather here is pretty good today, pretty similar to San Diego, and we look forward to you guys being here in Arizona and look forward to seeing you in the next year.
Thank you very much.
Okie doke.
Thank Bye-bye. You.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, next up is Barry Best, Phlebotomy Training Academy, and I am the board lead. So I'm going to, before we get started, I'll turn over to Mr. LaMountain to make some, give us some background, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Mittman and board. Before the board is Barry Best Phlebotomy. It's an initial application for conditional non-accredited vocational program in phlebotomy. They're located in Tucson, Arizona. And today we have Ms. Kelly Ellsbury. Representing who is the owner representing the institution.
Great. Well, welcome, Ms. Ellsbury. Would you like to make an opening comments or remarks?
Definitely. Good afternoon, everyone. I just want to mention briefly, I should be at 100% today, but I did suffer a stroke Saturday evening. I completely lost the left side of my body for over an hour. It was very unexpected. Just kind of one of those freak things. MRIs and everything show that I'm now at 100% with one small issue that I'm kind of noticing that may affect me talking today. I'm just kind of noticing that involuntary swallowing. Sometimes the saliva tends to go down the wrong pipe, so I kind of do a lot of clearing my throat to ensure that that doesn't happen. So just kind of wanted to touch on that briefly. But yes, I actually incorporated back in March of 2019. I have been in healthcare, starting off in neurology, neuroscience, back about 15 years ago. I went predominantly laboratory, I want to say about maybe 10 years ago, starting off just as a lab worker as well as a phlebotomist. Started off training other individuals as PCTs over at University Medical Center before it became UPH Urbana. Later went on to become nationally certified with National Health Career Association. And since that time, I have coordinated both pharmaceutical and bio laboratories, a district for a global mobile laboratory before starting my own mobile lab service about 3.5 years ago, which I currently own and operate now. On a contractual basis. One of my main clients is Mayo Clinic, for instance. I handle all of their autoimmune and genetic testing patients for all of Arizona and parts of Nogales, Mexico. At this point, obviously throughout my career coordinating, I've overseen a number of different teams of lab technicians / phlebotomists. I've trained a number of different individuals and just kind of recognized that there were a lot of things applying to practical application that didn't seem to be taught when they were initially training and was causing issues later for patients. So I just kind of wanted to create an avenue to kind of maybe alleviate some of that.
Okay, well, great. Well, welcome. And I'm glad that you're feeling better. Sounds like
thank you.
It's been rather scary.
Very. Just so happened my significant other noticed what was happening, basically broke the sound barrier to get me to the hospital in the speed of light. And thanks to that and being of pretty good health, I ended up making a complete reverse. Thank you for that.
Okay, well, great. Questions? Would anyone else like to start? Otherwise, I have a list of questions that I will follow up with.
I do have a few that we maybe will be able to move fairly straightforward through. I noticed, and just in reviewing records and kind of looking at them, there was a personal finance record that was provided, but the math didn't quite seem to make sense. There seemed to be maybe some obligations, but then they didn't get tallied up at the bottom. I don't know if the staff had a chance to review that or if there are questions around that or a more updated version was provided.
Is it okay if I answer?
By all
means, I don't
want
to cut you off.
Go ahead,
Ann. Oh, okay. So yeah, Terry and I had kind of discussed that. The form that I used was a form that I had already submitted formally when seeking financial assistance alone. So I used that same form because it was so recent. The issue with that form is that it's even a little confusing to me. At the bottom, it asks for both net worth as well as like basically what I'm paying out. So to try to kind of satisfy both questions, if I'm not mistaken, the most updated one has one figure and then there's like a slash, a forward slash, and then there's another figure because I was kind of trying to answer both questions. Does that make sense?
It does. It just wasn't clear. It looked like you maybe had a liability, a larger liability with maybe a bank loan or something of that nature that wasn't necessarily accounted for. So it was hard to get clarity if you're financially stable for this entity or not. So that was the reason for that question.
Let me pull that while you're talking. Let
sure.
me pull that.
And I don't mean to get into I don't mean to get into the personal finances necessarily on record in this meeting, but merely just to call out that may be an opportunity to just provide an updated record or clarity in your work with the staff. The other piece is that on the application itself, question number 4 was not answered. All else was answered, but I didn't know if question number 4, if there was a reason or again, maybe I'm just not seeing an updated version. Again, you don't need to necessarily answer that at this point, but just for staff's review from that, they may want to go back and validate, at least maybe answered in another area that I did not see. And then
can you remind me as to what number 4 is?
It's a standard question in regards to if any applicant has ever been convicted of a felony or misdemeanor other than that of a minor traffic offense. It's kind of a dotting of the I and crossing of the T. But the question was not answered on the application that I had for review.
It is answered in one of the documents that we have.
Perfect. That's all I was trying to verify. Sometimes we have multiple documents, and I see it, I don't see it, and I wanted to just verify. So thank you for that.
Could I just check, was the misdemeanor that you cited there, was it expunged from the record, Ms. Ellsbury? Was that a yes?
It was set aside.
Is that the right term, is it? I'm familiar with.
Yes, it's Arizona's version of assessment. It's called set aside. I think so can you guys hear me?
Yes and no. So can I just ask, and this is a little bit of a side, Mr. Monahan, set aside, is that the same as expunged?
Well, I don't practice in criminal law. Thank you, Chair Mittman, for the question. Yes, generally a set aside is the same as an expungement.
And so technically, does Ms. Ellsbury have to answer that as a – could she just answer no if it's been expunged or set aside?
Well, again, that's – you know, it's more of a question of transparency. So, you know, did she have to? Probably not. Could we find it out? Probably. So maybe a good thing that she did note it.
Okay.
I just wanted to be honest.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your honesty. And I just wanted to be clear just because I know, you know, when someone's record is expunged, you know, the purpose of that is so that it, you don't have to keep bringing it up. But thank you for your honesty and transparency there. And back to you, Mr. Romano. I don't want to, sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no worries. I'll finish off here. When I'm looking at the 220 hours at 39 sessions that are at 6 hours apiece with a half an hour lunch, I can't seem to make the math work to get to 220 hours in kind of that 39 sessions. It seems as though it needs to be 4 sessions to get to the 220 hours. Which would make it 8 full weeks instead of, I think, the 7.5 that you've mentioned in your catalog and that. But maybe I'm missing something. So I thought I'd at least bring it forward to see if maybe I was.
Okay. Let's see. 6 times 39 gives
9 times 0.5 is 19.5, 234 minus 19.5. No, that's not right. 234. I kept coming up with 214.5 myself.
And that is what's
happening. But if you do it against 40, yeah, if you do it against 40 class sessions, you come out just fine. But that would take it to 8 weeks. So you may just need to correct that piece of it. It seemed like a competitive advantage you were bringing forward was the 7.5 weeks. I don't know if 8 is still competitive or not, but it probably just correcting that would be great. And the last thing I would say is, in regards to complaints, the way I understand your current structure, you are the only employee of the company, and thus you're giving instruction, you're overseeing it, but yet you, in most cases, we say, please make sure you say, if you have a complaint, that you or a delegate will review it. I'm trying to figure out, are you planning on bringing somebody else on board that would become a delegate?
Absolutely. Just for startup, I mean, we're literally looking at the very, very first class. It'll be me solely. But the last couple of months, as I waited on the board meeting, I had to keep the place up and running. I already have the space, I have the insurance, and I'm paying for monthly, you know, so I had to keep costs down until I can actually have a class, because obviously I can't get my curriculum and run the business without the license. So yeah, I already have my office manager in mind. I'm going to be bringing on 2 instructors and an office manager. So yeah, that structure will change. Won't just be me.
Great. I appreciate that. That's all I have, Dr. Mittman.
Okay. All right. So a few questions, and then I'll kick it back over to the rest of the board. In your business plan, you mentioned 2 funding rounds in 2020. Were those grants or loans?
loans. The Kiva loan is no interest. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Kiva, but it's a crowdfunding loan. So it's done a little bit differently. And the second is a loan as well, a small loan. There is a very low interest on that. What's nice about that's through MicroCare Arizona. What's nice about that loaning institution is that by basically creating that rapport with them, that will actually give me access to financial assistance going forward. So basically, as long as I'm up on pace with them, if any emergencies should take place where I need funds to continue to run the business while I'm trying to get up to a suitable revenue, they are there to provide that. They promise that. So, yes, they are loans. They're not grants.
So I, going back to Mr. Romano's first question, I don't think that those were on the personal financial statement. And so they should be, right, because it's like – you know, any other loan that you have, a car loan or whatever. So that needs to be there. And so what is the, what's the payback? Is it a monthly payback? Because I also didn't see that reflected in your budget and pro forma moving forward.
Okay. So what was a little challenging about that is I wasn't sure how to structure it because I'm currently running, you know, a business as a contractor that's totally separate. So it kind of became difficult, like, okay, do you guys want that information? Because I am using funds from that to, you know, invest in the business myself as well. And then at that time, the loan payments weren't due. Like, the loan payments aren't due to start until March. So I wasn't sure whether or not that was considered current at that time to add. So it was really more of a question of timing and things like that. So if you want that, I can update it and provide it. I really just wasn't sure if that was relevant at the time.
I think the question is, you know, first of all, and I don't have all the documents in front of me, but there's a budget. There's a budget document that you fill out that has your projection for, you know, your number of students, your revenue, and your expenses. So this would be an expense, right? Because you're going to have a loan repayment on those two loans, with or without interest or whatever the interest is. So it needs to be there. There are also liabilities for you, and so it should be on your personal financial statement.
Okay.
Right. If you, in one of your documents, you mention industry opportunities. It may be on your website, actually. You list a bunch of industry opportunities, but the only one that really pertains to the phlebotomy program would be a phlebotomist, right? There are other comparisons, so those were kind of irrelevant. How about the number of venipunctures that your students will perform? I didn't see anything about a specific number that they have to do. So is there like a total number of venipunctures that's required?
It's included in the catalog on, let's see here. Let's see. It should be in the catalog here just a moment. Persona shower. Okay. It's included in under educational services 6E.
Okay.
220 clock hours, total of 39 sessions, 6-hour classes with 30-minute lunch, totaling, let me see here, instruction in venipuncture, totaling 220 instruction hours, minimum of 30 venipunctures and 10 capillary sticks on live persons, followed by certified phlebotomy tests, tech testing with National Health Career Association. So it's there. It's just in the catalog.
30, and it's 30 venipuncture or 30 total?
No, it's 30, and it's itemized. So it's 30 venipunctures, and then you have 10 capillary sticks, which are the finger sticks.
Uh-huh.
So that's included in the short. It's what's, I went along the guidelines because the teaching material and the entire training is structured to get the students to pass satisfactorily the national CPT test with National Health Career Association. So the whole program is geared towards making sure their requirements are met.
So in also in the documents that you provided, you stated that the students are going to be doing venipunctures on each other, right? And anybody who likes them or loves them enough to come in and be their practice partners. How many students are you anticipating? I'm just trying to do the math in my head. Like, how many times, if I were a student, how many times am I going to have to get stuck?
Right, I understand. So this is just during COVID. Like, of course, we don't know how long that's going to last because actual structure.
Yeah, what happens after COVID?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
After COVID.
Well, after COVID.
So what do people do?
I have externships lined up. I'm in negotiations for that. The original model, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the way that beauty schools operate, where they have people come in and they either get low cost or free hairdo to have the students practice. So my Mayo Clinic client, for example, they sign off, and I actually plan to do this for the public. There'll be free venipunctures. So let's say you have an order from a doctor, okay? You can come in, get that order filled. We take care of the venipuncture and the processing, and then I do nightly drop-offs to LabCorp or NorQuest, depending on what the insurance of the patient is for the actual testing. But since COVID's going on, I really don't think it's safe to have, you know, to have that many people coming in and out of the school daily right now. I mean, the last thing I need is an outbreak of COVID at school, at the school, especially it being so new.
What about, and I'm not familiar with the certification guidelines for phlebotomy, but do you also have to do, like, butterfly sticks, and do you have to... Do students have to do it on veins other than the popliteal fossa? You know, or people with skinny veins or fat people where there's lots of stuff on top of it, or old people like me where everything is fragile. So what's the...
It's not necessary, but I will make it a prerequisite at the school. I'll provide that. See, my issue, and this is the whole reason for the school, you know, me coming up with the school in the first place, is that phlebotomists are released to go and work, and they don't know how to do that. You know what I mean? They don't know how to draw a range of different people. And honestly, when you go in, you know, I mean, I just feel like it shouldn't be a difference between... a good phlebotomist and a phlebotomist. They should be one and the same. You shouldn't have to worry who's going to come in the room and stick you. Do you know what you're doing or don't you? You know what I mean? So no, it's not a requirement for certification, but it is one of the things that I will actually provide as far as instruction, because practical application will be my main directive. Yes, that's great. Okay, you know terminology, you know all those great things. Can you stick these people?
See,
so I'm trying to release graduates out there who know what they're doing.
Very good phlebotomist, right?
Exactly. Okay. Very good phlebotomist, indeed.
So what's your competition in Tucson like? Like how many
Let's
other?
Let's see. I would say the biggest is PMI.
Okay.
So we got Pima Medical Institute. They're about $500 more for their course, but their course is also double the length of mine just to get the same results.
And so just one of the board members is associated with PMI, actually, I think is the founder of PMI.
Hi.
Say all kinds of factual things, and anything beyond factual, just say good things about, say Barry.
Sure. And I mean, I actually have a great respect for PMI, you know. So, I mean, the building that I'm renting space in, PMI's corporate office is there. And one of the reasons I chose that location is it's rented through Larson Baker. And when I went to see the property initially to choose where I wanted it to go, they said to me, hey, you know, PMI is over here. You know, they really don't think about things as a competition. They think of things more of as a co-op petition. And that's what stood out to me. I'm not here to necessarily compete with them. I mean, business-wise, I guess. But at the same time, I'm just adding to the industry, if that makes sense at all.
So their advantage is shorter duration, a little bit less expensive, right? And anything else that kind of distinguishes Very Best from the other programs that are out there?
Maybe my emphasis on making sure they get all those different type of people that you just talked about. I mean, like I said, throughout the time that I've coordinated, I mean, I've just seen people who are certified and working, and mind you, in a mobile capacity. So there was like no one else, if they couldn't get this person in two sticks, to come behind them and do it. You know, so you're going on a 4.5-hour trip to go and see someone and you don't know what you're doing because you don't know how to do a manual draw, for example. This person's on an anti-coag, you're blowing veins all over the place and you still don't get the specimen that you need. And then more people have to go and drive that 4.5 hours. I had one guy. He was 94 years old. He had been stuck 24 times in 3 days. Before I was able to go over there and get him on the first stick. And the problem was they kept trying to use vacutainers with the man. But when you're on an anti-coag like warfarin, something that's strong like that, it's too much pressure for the vein. So you need to do a manual setting where you have a butterfly and a syringe. So after I drew him, you know, I called up, you know, some of the phlebotomists because at that time I was coordinating for the district. So I called a couple of phlebotomists and told them how I got him so going forward they would know. And I was getting question marks. What's a manual draw?
Okay.
I was shocked that they didn't know that.
Clearly, you know phlebotomy is very passionate about it, and we really appreciate that. How many students do you anticipate enrolling in the next 6 months?
Hopefully, well, I have a waiting list of people who've been waiting for like 8 months already, and that's about 40 people. I would say maybe, and this is lowballing here, I would say I should be able to get at least 12 people, and that's being really modest. Maybe 12 people in the next 6 months, because that would be what? The first two classes, I would say 12.
Okay.
Mind you, I'm only doing half classes because of COVID. Each class fits 24 students. I'm cutting that in half due to social distancing. So I won't accept more than 12 students at a time. So maybe I'll be able to fill each class with maybe half that number. So perhaps 6 to 12 students in the next 6 months.
Okay, great. Other questions from board members? Did everybody go to lunch? It was just the two of us. I see Mr. LaMountain there. Okay.
Mr. LaMountain and Mr. Kears is here. I see them.
So hearing none, then I will make a motion to approve provisional license. I'm sorry, I should get the exact wording here. Hold on a sec. Provisional license for Very Best Phlebotomy. And I don't have it in front of me, Mr. LaMountain. Is there a surety bond as well? Yeah, with a $15,000 surety bond. Right. And was there any corrections to the materials that came up? Can't remember hearing.
Yes, I think 220 hours should be corrected.
Right. Okay.
And corrections made that. Ms. Ellsbury will follow up with staff on those. But that wasn't a very concise motion.
And Dr. Mettman, just to clarify your motion, if you will, it's a conditional non-accredited, not provisional?
Okay, I'm sorry. I keep saying that. A conditional non-accredited license for Barry Best Phlebotomy pending corrections made that Ms. Ellsbury will share with the staff.
This is Dick for a second.
Okay, good. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Ms. Ellsbury, assuming that we vote aye, do you agree to the stipulations?
I just want to be clear. So correct to 8 weeks to equal 220 hours. And then do you want me to send you an updated financial? The projection should include the loan payment, but not the financial statement. Would you like me to update that?
So that when we go from conditional to full license, it doesn't put you behind the eight ball by, you know, understating your, So yes, please.
Sure. Okay.
Good. All right, Ms. Kearse, call the roll.
Mr. Mike Romano, your vote?
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck?
We got aye.
And Mr. Dick Lupke?
Aye.
I can't tell you anything about Mr. Scott Wallace?
Aye.
And Dr. Paul Bayman?
Aye.
Ayes have it.
Thank you guys so very much, and thank you to Keith Blanchard and Terry. Your staff is absolutely fantastic, and they've been very helpful. I appreciate you.
Well, you're very welcome. And if I'm if I happen to be in Tucson, I happen to have like the best veins. I have a long sleeve shirt on, so I can come in and your students can practice on me. So thank you very much.
We love to see you. I'll buy you lunch.
All right, well, be fun, and continue on your path to full health. So best wishes. Okay.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Call to the public.
Chair Mittman?
Yes.
Chair Mittman, this is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. I just wanted to clarify something. I misspoke earlier on your question regarding expungement and set-asides. Arizona does not allow expungement. They only allow set-asides, and they do not function the same. Essentially, a set-aside will just restore your rights, whereas the expungement will get rid of it.
Okay.
Well, so I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. Well, thanks, and I appreciate that. All right. Call to the public. We saw Fred Lockhart on the call earlier.
Yeah, he had to he had to leave a few minutes ago.
Okay. Well, let the record show that we acknowledge Fred and thank him, because I know that he played an important role in lobbying or whatever the legislation that's been introduced.
Right.
So thanks. All right. Hearing none, it is 1:22, and I want everybody to note that we are done in 3 hours and 22 minutes. So thanks, everybody. This is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.